welcome to this brand new episode of the Silmarillion Film Project. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and from Pasadena, I want to wish you happy International Women's Day, which That's we right. totally planned our content around. Right, guys?
Absolutely. Because we're so topical and, like, yep. dynamic and with it. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is International Women's Day, and whether intentional or you catastrophically, a lot of our conversation today is going to be on a digression away from some of the planned, sort of storyline stuff we were going to do. We're going to be talking. One of the topics today is going to be about women in elven society, which is so we are very topical and with it.
Absolutely.
We're so with it. We didn't even have to intentionally do that. We just right. subconsciously
it's just like naturally. Yeah, exactly. The relevance just bubbles up spontaneously.
Yeah. Or probably what we should say is that maybe our listeners and our most active participants on our discussion in our forum are very topical with it.
So. Or perhaps more with it than we are. Yeah. That's also a very absolutely. Distinct possibility.
Regardless, the end is the same. So I'm joined, as always, by Corey Olson, the Tolkien professor, and Trish Lambert, the Tolkien maven. And so today's going to be an exciting topic in addition to talking a little bit about sort of very, very prescient issues in as portrayed in a fictional elven society. We're also going to talk about dragons and some other fun things. First, I think probably you have an announcement, huh, Corey?
Oh, do I have an announcement? I actually have a massive
number. You're awash in announcements.
I'm awash in announcements. I have two slides of announcements today.
Is panoply a good word
panoply,
for that?
My full panoply of announcements. I have a plethora of announcements
plethora.
Today.
I like I'm it. That's what Daffy Duck would say. You have a plethora.
I'm going to try not to spend too much time on the announcements because there's so much going on all of a sudden. So first, a reminder about our moots, which are coming up. We've got three big moots that are happening. First, Sunshine Moot, which is happening now in under 2 weeks. That's almost true. Tomorrow, 2 weeks from tomorrow, it is. That's super exciting. There's still time to sign up and everything. So please do join us down in Orlando or near Orlando on March 23rd for Sunshine Moot. And then there's Nader Moot in Leiden in the Netherlands on April 13th. It's our Europe Moot this year. So I hope you can join us for that too. And then, of course, Myth Moot 6, which with its theme of dragons this year. The end of June, 27th through the 30th, our big annual 4-day mega conference down in the Washington, D.C. area. And the call for papers is open through the end of this month, March 31st. So those are our big events that are coming up here in the next few months. But we also have some other online events that are happening very much sooner, such as one that's happening this very day as is, this afternoon in like 7 hours. In fact, exactly 7 hours from this moment, I will be broadcasting again with Maggie Park, the new director of the Mythgard Institute, to talk about the second Tolkien trailer, the trailer for the new Tolkien biopic that dropped. So we're going to be we'll be examining the second trailer as we examine the first one a couple weeks back. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And then on Sunday, this coming weekend, Sunday, March 10th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Dave and Trish and I here are going to get together again, and we are going to talk about that map, right? So the Amazon Prime folks have been steadily and cunningly teasing material through that interactive map that they've released. And so we've been kind of waiting for more stuff. We almost wanted to jump on that instantly as soon as the very first version came out. I'm kind of glad we waited because there's a lot more to talk about now. So we're gonna kind of talk about that map and what that map suggests and what we can what we think about it and what we can learn about it. That's going to be pretty cool. I'm going to be really excited about that. There's even a chance that we might have some additional special guests joining us, which I can't confirm yet, but there's a chance of it.
Fingers crossed,
we'll see. And in any case, you'll get the three of us, and that is sufficiently awesome.
I can't help feeling that anybody who listened to Riddles in the Dark, they're going to have deja vu.
Yeah. That's what this is going to be like.
Exactly. It's going to be like, now, it's not, the one way in which my plan is for it not to be like Riddles in the Dark is that the episode shouldn't be 3 hours long, but we'll
right.
see.
And we're not going to ask questions at the end.
And we're not going to ask questions at the end. Exactly.
Didn't we used to say that during Riddles in the Dark?
Yeah, yeah, Dave,
oh,
had
said
to
it
remind
about, he said it about sound film. We said it about exploring Lord of the Rings,
exactly.
You know.
That's, yeah, exactly. What can I do? Anyway, okay. And the third thing is starting today, we're doing a new Anytime Audit special at Signum University on our sci-fi part one, our science fiction survey part one class. So through the 22nd of May, March. 22nd of March, it is still March, it's not quite yet May yet, we're doing, the Anytime Audit tuition for our science fiction part one course is down to only $75, so that's going on starting today. Now, that's the first page of announcements. The second page of announcements is next week. Next, I will need a whole other page for next week. In fact, I needed most of a page just for next Thursday, where we have three different events going on Thursday next week. First, I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be driving down to the LOTRO offices, the Standing Stone offices, to have another fun session with Chris Pearson and Michael Drought. The three of us are going to get together and talk about LOTRO and Tolkien and stuff, and that'll be broadcast on the LOTRO stream on Twitch. So twitch.tv/LOTROstream at 11 a.m. on next Thursday. Then we're having Thesis Theater. One of our thesis students who has finished is going to be presenting on his master's thesis work on C.S. Lewis's Discarded Image and his space trilogy. That's going to happen at 6 o'clock. And then the Mythgard Movie Club is going to be meeting at 8:30 on Thursday night to talk about Blade Runner 2049. They talked about the old Blade Runner movie a couple months ago, or last month, recently, anyway, and they're going to talk about the new Blade Runner movie on next Thursday. So that'll be really cool, too. And then next weekend, we're having a New York City moot up. So we're not doing a real moot. We're not doing a full conference in New York. But that's the weekend that there's the Tolkien Symposium at the Morgan, and the New York Tolkien Conference is happening. So a bunch of us are going to be down there. I'm going to be down there at both events that weekend as well. So we're just going to have a get together. Anybody is invited. Anyone who wants to come and get together and hang out and meet up with us, you can. You do need to RSVP for that so we can, like, because we're going to be at a restaurant, so we need to tell people, like, about how many people to expect. So do RSVP. And the information on that and all of these other things, further information, including registration links and all the stuff, is on the Mythgard and Signum events page. So go to signumuniversity.org/events, and this is the page, you can go down and see here's the today's trailer discussion and the map discussion and the thesis theater and the Blade Runner show and the moot up, and here you just send an email to info@signumu.org in order to RSVP, but that information is on the page here too, as well as where we're going to be. And then you've got Sunshine Moot registration, Nader Moot, and Myth Moot registration all there on the events page, so you can find it yourself. Or again, if you just go to the signumuniversity.org website, you'll find it in its normal place right here below the link to the science fiction class, down all of our upcoming events in order. And those are my very numerous and exciting announcements for today. Whew, I'm tired now. Okay. Now, let us get back to discussing the bad guys, because that's where we were. So our goals for this session, and you'll notice that the first goal that has been set for us for this session is that this shall be our final session on the overarching storylines.
I noticed
that Marie very gently put the word final in all caps there, which I think is perfectly appropriate, and which we can certainly do. David, did I mess up the date? I'm sorry. The webpage is correct. The Moot Up is on the 17th. It's on the Sunday. I think I did put the 16th on my slide, didn't I? Sorry. That's my fault. See, look at this. And I do it myself. It all gets messed up.
Corey, you have definitely so few things website. In your day you have to deal with. You'd think you could get the day right.
No, seriously. I know, but it's actually not that hard to type the correct date. It's not too much to ask, I should say. But whatever. Anyway, sorry, David, thank you for pointing that out. It's on the, yeah. Okay. All right, David, now I'm confused. Never mind. Okay. We're going to go with the webpage is almost certainly correct. If we differ, the webpage is almost certainly correct. And if I'm confused, who is surprised? Okay. But anyway, back to our goals for the session. So three things. Well, okay. So we had two things to talk about, and they've now expanded to three things. The two things we were bringing over from last time are the creation of dragons. That was the we spent most of last time talking about the bad guy storyline, especially as related to the fall of man. And that was a really great discussion in which we made a lot of progress, I think, on a lot of unexpected things. And that was very cool. But we didn't get to dragons. And there are some issues with Glaurung that we need to sort out. So let's definitely, we're definitely going to work on that. And then, of course, we've been at the tail end of our list of things that we wanted to talk about in these overarching storyline sessions is Luthien, right? We don't want to just leave Luthien behind. We don't want Luthien to be a one-trick pony. We want to show that Luthien has obviously an important role. I mean, it's one of those things, the emphasis that is laid on how, like, the elves of Middle-earth have lost Luthien, right, suggests that she's way important beyond her family circle, right? She has to mean something, like, to elvendom on Earth. And she can't do that if she's hiding away in Menegroth the whole time and no one's ever met her, right? Other than her family and the other folks there at Menegroth. So we need to think about some role for her to play without spoiling her role in, of course, the actual Luthien and Baron story. So that's the other thing that we need to think about. Now, and the anticipation of that has led us broadly, meaning our discussion board folks, to this bigger question about healers and their role in elven society and thinking about the roles of women in particular. And this is also a kind of, oh, perhaps referendum is too harsh a word, and I don't want to sound too teasing or to make it sound like we're being taken to task. But I think it's a really important question to open the question of how do we handle minor characters and what's going on with our minor characters in the story. And in particular, of course, this has a big, given the nature of the Silmarillion and the published Silmarillion and how it works, that is to say, given the small number of female characters. Now, you know, goodness knows, as all Tolkien fans know, whenever they hear, people say, like, oh, there are no good female characters in Tolkien, or, you know, almost no good female characters in Tolkien, most, you know, Tolkien fans will all immediately say, oh, well, you have to read the Silmarillion, right? There's Luthien, and there's Haleth, and there's lots of really cool characters, and there's Arathel, and, you know, sure, absolutely. But by number, right, if you count noses, there are fewer,
There we go.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, am I back? Sorry.
Corey, went away. I don't, we what was he saying, guys?
Sorry. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. You might have lost me there for a while. Okay. Yeah, I apologize. It looks like my internet was having a little problem. The good thing is that people at home will almost certainly hear me. Okay.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, that's good.
Okay.
We'll just have to deal with this bizarre interruption.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, okay. So what I was saying was when people complain about female characters in Tolkien, most Tolkien fans say, well, have you read the Silmarillion? Like, there are lots of awesome female characters in the Silmarillion, which is certainly true. However, by number, there are way fewer female characters in the Silmarillion. And, the vast majority of the elvish family trees are male, right? bunches of brothers and their sons and all that kinds of thing. So now Tolkien did do, names for wives and sisters and things in much of his later work. But they're not part, they're not much part of the published story. As a consequence, we have had a small tendency to kill them off with regularity over the course of some films so far. So a reexamination of that policy and thinking that through a little bit more is definitely something that I think is totally worthwhile for us to do. So, yep. Anyway, that's what we're going to be. So we're going to be thinking about that in the context of thinking about in this context, as we're building up towards thinking about Luthien specifically. So that's what we're going to do. Yeah, Carita does point out the dead sister, wife, mother thing is kind of a trend. I know, it is, right? We'll get there. We'll work. Totally legit concern, and, we will think about it. But let's think about dragons first. Okay, so the issue is... Okay, so there seem to me two primary questions about Glaurung. First, the question is, to what extent do we want to show his development, right? Are we going to show the process for developing dragons? Is there going to be a process? As we have in our slide here, are we going to get failed attempts, right? Is Glaurung going to be...
We have a comic montage of Danny failures.
Exactly. I don't know. I think that it's there are lots of ways that this could be done, and I think it could be really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, imagining one easily could imagine that, Sauron and Morgoth came up with a bunch of projects that didn't pan out. They don't have to be comical, right? They could just not work, right, particularly well. I don't know. I would be a little bit tempted, I have to admit, to have them try to develop an air force, because was one of Morgoth's great failings was that he didn't have an air force. Having him develop something which then gets like demolished by the Eagles and he has to go back to the drawing board is a thing that I could, or a Navy, Marie, absolutely. Or a Navy. So thinking about, him attempting to establish mastery of the air and of the sea and failing to do that, that I think is definitely a viable opportunity. And Ellen, exactly, but it's important that we're far away from winged dragons, because of course winged dragons are going to be ultimately the success, or the greatest success anyway, at the last minute, that he's going to have on that one. But there's no reason to think he's not thinking about that earlier on, right? Especially as he's watching the Eagles around. So, yeah, Håkon, of course, is thinking of the Watcher in the Water and wondering if, that could be a descendant of an early experiment, which is interesting, right? Definitely an interesting question. So I'm open to it. I guess my thought is I can't imagine spending a lot of screen time on this without it seeming kind of like a weird aside, right? I don't see, it's hard for me to see how it's part of a story exactly. I mean, other than, I guess if we can work it in some kind of integrated way with the early stages of the season where, the sun is out and the bad guys are still in a, okay, what now? How do we move forward in the new situation kind of thing? But I think that we have a risk of making them look incompetent. And I'm not sure exactly if we can pull that off without making it look, without making them look silly.
I'm not at all confident that we can do this in a way that it won't look silly.
Yeah, I'm not either. I mean, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, we did. Marie and Nick are both reminding us that we did have a lot of monsters in the War of the Powers in season one, including a Watcher in the Water type. We actually, I'd forgotten that we had thrown that in there.
I'm down with monsters, but I think like scenes of them tinkering with the monsters.
Now Tony points out that it does live up with the trend of Morgoth perverting existing creatures, which is a good trend to emphasize, right? So that we can get that pattern in people's mind, right? That Morgoth is not a creator, but a corrupter of existing things. We have not shown him capturing and corrupting ants, for instance, right? Nor do I think we want to show that, but we can provide enough examples to sort of show how that sort of thing is done. And so therefore, to enable us to plant the idea later on, right? That's where trolls came from. Anyway, okay. Now Ellen was suggesting that the dragons should stay as a reaction to the failure at the Dagor Aglareb, and that does make a lot of sense to me, Ellen. The one objection, well, not objection, but the one thing that I might add to that, though, is especially if the Dagor Aglareb is Morgoth's plan, then yes. If Morgoth is like, okay, let's run with the Dagor Aglareb, green light on the Dagor Aglareb, and then it fails. And then they're like, okay, we gotta up our game here, or this isn't going to work out, right, with the Noldor. If that's the story, then it makes sense that the dragons would be the way to do that. However, if the Dagor Aglareb, I think we were suggesting earlier in last week's or last time's episode that the Dagor Aglareb basically gets kicked off while Morgoth is away, corrupting men out in Hildorian, right? So Morgoth is in Hildorian, and while he's away, Sauron and Gothmog, but primarily Gothmog, pushes forward the Dagor Aglareb, and it fails. That opens up the possibility that basically that would not have been Morgoth's timing. Morgoth could have begun. Glaurung's a long-term project, right? He's growing for a while. Which means I think we need to suggest some kind of process there, right? Like this is not just a, you know, we don't just need a ribbon cutting ceremony on Glaurung, right? We need the sense that this is something that Morgoth is infusing with power and is growing over time. In which case, he would have already begun Glaurung before the Dagor Aglareb, and his whole plan was to wait until Glaurung was done, and then he comes back and finds that Gothmog has pulled the trigger on the Dagor Aglareb, you know, on the assault, the orc assault, prior to Glaurung's being ready, and he's like, you moron, right? And then Sauron is like, yeah, dude, you're a moron. Remember, we talked about that last time, about how Sauron is kind of ready to have it both ways, right? He has set up the betrayal so that the Dagor, the orc assault can succeed, in which case he can take credit for that. But he's also positioned Gothmog to be the one who initiated it. So if it fails, he can be like, yeah, it was his stupid idea, right? So, I think that kind of works.
I have a question. This might be a bit of a diversion. It probably is actually a diversion. But it occurs to me as I'm reading and, you know, thinking about Marie's slide here. Is he a Maia?
Well, okay. So, yeah.
Because he's got his own, no other creature other than Maia-type creatures have their own wills, I suppose you could call it. You know what I mean? And he definitely does.
It's really hard to see Glaurung any other way. I mean, the kind of force of will that he has. I mean, he's not just an unusually smart reptile, for crying out loud, right? But here's basically, this is not something that Tolkien ever spelled out. This is not 100% clear. And to be perfectly honest, there are serious problems either way you go. If you say that Glaurung's will and intelligence comes from the spirit of Maia, which has been fused into the body of a beast, what about his children? How are his children into... I mean, I guess you can say...
Well, I'm thinking Ungoliant. I mean, Ungoliant was a Maia, right? The way we have her.
Sort of. I mean, yeah.
She had children.
Least. No, I'm not saying they can't have children. I mean, we know that Maia can have children. But... So... It's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable in a couple ways. The way that... So you think about... Okay. We have three models, okay? Arguably three different models for how Ainu spirits can become connected to flesh, okay? Model number one is the I'm choosing to manifest myself in a fleshly body. Right?
Right.
The thing that all the Valar can do. So the Melian is in this position, right?
Uh-huh.
Ungoliant was in that position, right? That was
right.
her body that she took on her. You know,
She chose that
fleshly form, right? Morgoth originally chooses his flesh before. Now his relationship with his fleshly form changes as his power changes, right? So we need to, so that's one thing, right? One example is that they manifest themselves in a body. The second example is what Tolkien emphasizes is the rather different relationship that, like, the Astari have with their bodies. Right, the wizards are incarnated in fleshly bodies. Gandalf's body is not
right.
just a manifestation in the same way that, you know, when Olmo appears in the surf to Tuor, right, he has a body. Presumably, if you had a big enough sword, you know, and could stab Olmo's body as he's standing in the surf, I don't think it would kill him, right? He's not going to die and his spirit pass back into Valinor. They don't have that kind of relationship with their bodies when they're in Type 1, right? When they're just manifesting a physical form. The Istari are incarnate in human, like in bodies. That's different, okay? Now, third, I would argue... and possibly in imitation of, or, you know, is what happens, like what is done to werewolves, right? Where a spirit is taken and housed in the body of a beast, presumably by force, and it's presumably unpleasant for everybody involved, seems to be, anyway, right? That is, and it's, it fits the pattern, it fits the pattern of, the, you know, the mockery, the imitation, right, of what Iluvatar does and what the Valar do by Morgoth.
Right.
So,
I could see Glaurung being more of the second type, believe it or not.
Well,
voluntarily, you know, or he could very well have been part of, you know, around.
We have, well, but see, if he's a spirit, so like we have. Think about the cast that we have, the evil cast that we have already, right? We've got people like Tivildo. Take Tivildo as an instance, right? Tivildo, he's type one, right? That is, he's a spirit who is manifesting a body.
Right, right. Oh, that's an interesting idea. Alan says maybe Glaurung started out as a Balrog.
Maybe. Maybe.
Hmm. I mean, I tend to think Glaurung would do this voluntarily, so it wouldn't be a type 3 thing.
And if it's a type one thing, it wouldn't be a process, right? It would just be Morgoth recruiting a spirit who then chose to manifest himself as a large lizard worm thing,
right?
Who could breathe fire and dominate people's wills, right? So like that would be, that wouldn't be hard. So I think it had, if it's going to be a process, it has to be essentially. So in my view, the difference between what I'm calling type two and type three, type two is like the good guys and type three is the bad guys. Like the difference between them really is that I am not sure. But you know, but Trish, you raise a really interesting point. If the spirit in question is willing, right? Mm-hmm. It's one thing for spirits to be compelled and for there to be this kind of horrifying necromancy thing, Ellen, as you were saying, or as I said, very understatedly, very unpleasant for everyone involved. But if there is a kind of willing incarnation, if some of the spirits, which are followers of Morgoth, say, we like the Astari, right? The Astari are spirits who volunteer for special duty, right? For this special relationship to Middle-earth, this special incarnation for them to go among the people of Middle-earth. What if some of the spirits under Morgoth say, hey, we're going to sign us up, right? We're going to do this thing. And Glaurung is the greatest of these. And so the project then is the fusing of the spirit and the formation of the development of the body,
right?
Which has to be kind of played out.
And there's nothing wrong with the idea that Glaurung isn't a partner in this process. You know, in other words, that he volunteers. For some reason, I was thinking back to how we've done the Balrogs, you know, how they were originally angelic and signed up with Melkor and, you know, that kind of thing. So there's no, I mean, Glaurung could be, whatever form he comes from could be, hey, pick me, coach. I'm in, I'm your partner. Let's do this thing, as opposed to an unwilling thing, like you were describing the type three. Now, the other reason for type two, of course, is when he dies, he needs to die. I mean, we can't have like the idea of Glaurung just hanging out there, like, you know, like a type one.
Right.
So it needs to be more like the Astari type, thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we do have, like Nick, you know, this is a big can to kick down the road is Smaug. Because Smaug has the same.
Well, that's it.
That same intent and intelligence and wiliness and all that stuff. So, you know.
And long process of growth, which all makes sense. It's not that we can't make that work, but.
Maybe he's a reincarnation of Glaurung. Maybe Glaurung is type one. Sorry.
Well, no, I mean, if we... Oh, man.
That's a real... Kidding!
They...
No doubt Tolkien would be thrilled by this conversation.
Oh, my God. He'd be like, no!
Well, but I mean, you know, this is... Look, it's largely his fault.
We're having say, he has no one to blame but himself.
No one to blame but himself.
He can't complain.
He's the one who liked dragons so much, so he put them in. I think they have to breed. They have to, because we have to have. I mean, most of them are going to be destroyed in the final battle, and then we're gonna. Well, we still need some down the road, like more than two. That is, we've got two named dragons, and I know that all but two die in the War of Wrath, but I mean, Ellen, I've always read that as like, it was a boy dragon and a girl dragon who survived the War of Wrath, so that's why we've got the Withered Heath and, you know, there be dragons up in the north, so, which is fine. Like, again, Tolkien specifically allows for a breeding pair to survive the War of Wrath, so that's fine. And Smaug can have ancestors, and a line, therefore, that goes back ultimately to Glaurung with adaptations. But, and I guess it's fine if we make him essentially a type two, then, you know, a spirit who is incarnated in a body. It's not a stretch, therefore, I suppose, to say that creature, Glaurung, right, in that state could have offspring, which would also, therefore, be intelligent and have wills like his. I mean, the question, you know, Ellen, the question that you were asking and the question which I'm like, don't want to even talk about because I don't know that we need to rule on it. But, like, Do dragons have souls, and where do they come from if they do? You know, the later dragons, not Glaurung. Where Glaurung's soul could come from is not hard, right? I mean, again, he just needs to be a spirit coming in, to be incarnate in that body.
I think Mangolian's offspring is a model for that, right? Shelob doesn't have a soul, right? I mean,
now there's a question that I don't know the answer to. Does she have a soul? What is that even, anyway, I don't even want to get, and that word, not even sure I want to go with that word, ultimately down the road, but, yeah. And
Tolkien put all these pesky little side creatures into the thing, you know, they're all just pesky, 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 pesky.
Exactly. Yeah. Marie, Fea rather than soul. I mean, And there are other terms we could use. Yeah. I know Ellen right. was talking about here, but the point is, like, whether or not they have a soul, this of course gets us directly into the question of, are they redeemable and all that. Like, we can't not use that word and not ask that question. So my suggestion is that we stop talking about this almost immediately. So if we assume that he's type two, then I think he can have kids. We can understand him having, we can understand both the process, the need for a process and growth, and we can understand his going on to sire broods of then breeding dragons to perpetuate dragon kind, which will eventually lead us to Smaug. So I think that that's fine.
All right. For my purposes, so I can make sure I record this accurately in a tweet. What are the three types again?
Okay. Oh yeah. So three types. Type one is when the Ainu being, like either Maiar or Valar, manifests a spiritual form.
Manifest themselves.
Right.
Yeah. They just manifest themselves. We'll call that the Almo's appearance.
Yeah. Exactly.
That also applies to what's her name? What's wrong with me?
Melian.
Yeah. Melian.
And Melian is obviously, you know, able to breed in that form. So that's obviously possible. That's okay. Could Gandalf sire kids, theoretically? Like, you know, I'm not saying he did. I'm not asking into, like, Gandalf's private life here. But I'm saying, is it, like, possible genetically for Astari to father children? What? He's built like a Kendall. No, he was not. I do not believe that. But anyway, yeah. No, he's certainly had a bladder.
Like,
in any case,
I was like getting cray off. That's awesome.
But anyway, yes, I do think. I mean, hey, goodness, this is something, like, we've got other wizards, right? Like, we were talking last week. Dave, we got into the Blue Wizards last week and everything, you know?
That's right.
I missed it.
You missed the Blue Wizards. So, we could have, do we have any absolute reason why one of the wizards wouldn't have children?
Progeny? Like, sure, not. Like, no,
we
yeah,
could,
right.
We could do that if we wanted to, right? Yeah, we could absolutely do that. Trish, Karita's thanking you for that nightmare
Karita,
image of the day.
I've given her an image. She's gonna
race. Right.
Hey, one. That's my job. That's my job.
Let's quickly review two and three.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Got you. So two is the the werewolf model. Right,
the forcible
thing. Yeah. Oh no! Sorry, three. Sorry. That was three.
Two is the
incarnation of the Astari, right? Where the spirit is incarnated in a form it tied to that form much more.
But it's mortal.
Fully.
It can die.
Yes.
I mean, the soul can die.
Voluntary incarnation.
Yes. Yes. Right. Voluntary incarnation, like incarnation. And then the third is like the sort of warped imitation of that we see in werewolves.
Willing versus unwilling, like Marie
willing
says.
Versus unwilling. Yeah. Yeah. So
forcible embodiment.
Forcible embodiment. Yes, exactly. And Marie is saying that the difference between two and three is willing versus unwilling. Yeah. Okay, here's my only quibble with going with that is I Does Morgoth have the power to do it? Type 2. Does he have the power to do type 2? Can he, without any help from Iluvatar, do the kind of clean incarnation thing that happened with the Istari? Or is the kind of warped werewolf thing the only option that is open to him on his own?
I incline to that latter view. I think technically speaking, yeah, but I don't know how we get around it. I mean, if he can't do type 2, I suppose if he can't do type 2, then it happened before he went back. You know, in other words, Glaurung was like a little newt.
A cheerful, friendly, back good newt.
Geico Gecko, you know.
The Geico Gecko is the ultimate progenitor of Glaurung. Now that's an image I didn't.
And he got Iluvatar to like do the thing for the Starry thing for him. You know what I mean?
I see.
But I don't see it. Otherwise. I don't know. You know, this is one of those ones I want to kind of like not get into detail and like don't say anything, and maybe the fans won't notice.
Yes.
Yeah. I think whatever we do. Absolutely, we do not want to have a conversation on screen between Morgoth and Sauron reviewing the different options.
Reviewing the different options.
Definitely
exactly.
Not.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, if Sauron does a slideshow presentation for Morgoth and like a collection of his closest counselors.
Right. Though Boomful's suggestion that we have an early unfallen Glaurung who is kind of like Charmander the Pokemon is quite charming, I have to admit. I think that, probably not. So,
Phil says now our out could be, does he need the power so much as the consent from the infusing spirit? Well, so it could be.
Right. Here's Marielle is helping me because I'm
good. Somebody needs to, because I'm certainly not helping.
I know you're really not. I am in that place where like you can tell that like I'm getting all twitchy, right? Like I really don't want to agree with that, but I'm trying to articulate why. Like, but anyway, Marielle has an excellent point, which is. If he can cleanly incarnate things, then it means that the wizards chronologically are a copy of dragons rather than like the other way around. And I agree.
The wizards should be an upgrade.
In the wizards, I think we should be seeing something that is unlike what we've seen before. Tim, don't get me wrong. When I'm talking about willing versus unwilling, I'm not at all suggesting... This is nothing about free will and whether they're choosing to go bad. Not at all. The spirits involved, all the spirits involved, like I'm presuming even the spirits in the werewolves, right, have chosen to go bad. That doesn't mean that they were chosen to be, like, painfully enslaved in the body of a wolf, however. That's all I'm talking... When I talk about willing or unwilling, I'm talking about willing or unwilling to be incarnated in that form, okay? It's not about willing or unwilling to be evil. That's totally not. You're absolutely right about that. That's totally not on the table. I'm not even talking about that.
I concur.
I think
type 2 should be the better Valar sort of analog of type 3.
Yeah, I like Hakan's idea. You know, Glaurung should be a willing subject but a minor survivor from the Atomno.
Yeah.
And if people really insist that Glaurung is not a type 3 and is closer to a type 2, then we can just have type 2A and type 2B.
Well, yeah, you know, sure. And goodness knows what we really want is like, you know, years down the road.
Complicated taxonomy.
And like people starting podcasts in which they do analysis of this to try to decide whether or not Glaurung is type 2 or type 3, then we've succeeded, right? So.
Yeah. Yep. I got hooked up on a little thing. I don't know if it was from people's comments or something we said, but something like, you know, there seemed to be some statement somebody made that Iluvatar would only do this for the Valar. But wait a second, folks. We got the music, okay? I'm not saying that Iluvatar would necessarily, you know, you just say, hey, Mel, you know, Morgoth, I'm going to give you a hand. I'm going to turn this dragon. But right. I want to just, I want to caution us to think about Iluvatar is not all pro-Valar all the time and anti-Morgoth. There is the music. The music's already happened.
And exactly. So, and the power that was delegated to Morgoth has been delegated to Morgoth.
Right.
And he is clear exactly as you say, Trish, from Iluvatar's reaction to Morgoth's discord is
right.
Morgoth can, you know, he does allow Morgoth to choose to do with the power that is given to him what he chooses
right.
to do. The point that he makes
right.
is not, Morgoth, I'm going to circumscribe your power and prevent you doing stuff. It's whatever you do is going to redound to my glory one way or the other.
Exactly. Eventually,
you
one
may
day.
As well come quiet.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
anyway, yeah.
I just wanted to say that because people were like, well, yeah. Iluvatar would, you know, he's
right.
kind of a neutral party at this point, folks.
Well, not neutral, certainly not morally neutral or anything like that, but he's, it's not, the key
what
there
I mean
is that
the music's
this time.
Already been,
exactly,
the music's the music.
Exactly, the key is at this time. Remember,
exactly.
this whole history we're telling is in a sense a retelling of what has already been, right? I mean, it's Iluvatar's relationship with this is not
right.
strictly chronological, so
right, right,
yeah. But anyway, yeah. Okay. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say is, I think the primary, in my mind, the primary difference between Type 2 and Type 3. I think the primary difference should not necessarily be willing versus unwilling, but should be like mechanism. Should be, well, I mean, okay, like this is just about the most pitiful way of describing it, but like one is good and the other one's bad. You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of what I'm getting at here. You know, like,
the key difference is good and evil.
Good and evil, exactly. Like that the evil one. I'm thinking back here to what we were saying about the orcs, right? Remember when Morgoth comes and takes over the necromantic orc project, which was already twisted and certainly evil, but Sauron wasn't trying to create, like, monstrous beings. He was trying to create dark elves, right? He was trying to create elves.
Right.
He was trying to adapt elves who would serve and worship them. And then Morgoth comes along and he's like, what I want are, you know, vicious, angry, hateful soldiers. And so but again, the important thing there is not just that he had a different vision for the project, but that he, his own anger and his own malice manifested itself in his works, right? And that's why I think that's the ultimate reason why I don't want Morgoth to be able to do that kind of clean,
mm-hmm.
sort of pure incarnation thing where it works mm-hmm. seamlessly and everybody's happy about it, because he's not happy about it. Like he's like, all of the works that he does are tainted with his discord, with his, you know, with the dissonance of his music, with the malice and anger, and selfishness of his, point of view that has been, you know, all of which things have been increasing as time has gone on. Exactly, Ellen, his hatred, it has to,
yeah.
The creation of dragons as an act of Morgoth needs to be, I think, manifestly an act of hatred, not just in its goal, right? Not just in that more, you know, Glaurung will become an instrument of hatred, but that, like, the very process itself, when Morgoth puts forth his power, he is putting forth his power in hatred. He despises his own servants, you know, as he despises his enemy. Like, he can't turn that off anymore.
Yeah. And I think it's also, I think another key is, it's not just sort of the intent and spirit in which that Morgoth is doing this, or the Valar and Iluvatar, but also the intent of the person being manifest. Like, I think, tell me if you disagree, but I think what the wizards do is fundamentally, or at least at the start, is fundamentally self-sacrificial.
Yes. Yes.
It's not like they're like, oh, great, I'm going on a vacation to Middle Earth. Like, it's
right.
Something they're doing.
And I get this sweet body, too. Awesome.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Whereas I think the spirits that are being manifest as dragons, even if it is voluntary, unlike the werewolves, it's still, there's something corrupt about it. Yes. Other, mm-hmm. you know, like right. They're not right. selflessly trying to serve the greater good as they perceive it. Like they're right. doing it because they seek power over others.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And Morgoth knows that. And so, you know, whereas the, you know, the, yes, like the spirits who are the Astari come, you know, in their initial commitment, of course. I think that's great. And Mariel was just pointing out a very similar thing, which I think is super important. As she says, they're reducing themselves to better serve the children of Iluvatar in doing that. It's an act of humility. Totally agree. And therefore, the Valar acknowledging, recognizing, and loving them for that, you know, help them and bless them for their act of self-sacrifice. Both sides of that work differently with Morgoth and Glaurung, right? Glaurung isn't doing it to lessen himself, right? He's doing this for his own advantage. Morgoth knows that he's doing it for his own advantage and wants to impose limitations on him because he doesn't want his servant getting uppity, right? And as,
right.
Well, and there will be tension, right? There will be tension, which segues us back to the problem of why does he get out in the first place? But hang on a second. Before I follow the full potential of that segue, do we want to show any progress? Do we want to tease it? Or let me ask the bigger question. How much of a surprise do we want Glaurung to be when Glaurung busts out? Do we want that to be a surprise to the audience or just to the elves?
I think a surprise to the audience.
I think that makes sense.
I think I'm in agreement that a surprise to the audience seems like more interesting and exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. We could have him be discussed. You know, there was the suggestion that we have somebody, you know, conversing with him. We hear him as a voice off screen within Angband, but we don't yet know who he is or what he is.
Should be suggested. There's a secret weapon. There's the, you know, the guy. Maybe we could maybe even feature the volunteer spirit on screen, be in discussion, but like what results his final form, I think should be, he should be a catastrophe.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. An anti-you catastrophe. Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, exactly, David, his appearance is a surprise without necessarily making his existence a surprise. Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes good sense. Okay. So yeah, we can find ways to tease that earlier on. And in the context of the teasing his existence, we can, you know, bring about the, some reference to his growth or like that he needs to develop further. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Now, Glaurung's escape. This is to me still the biggest challenge, and as I think I said when I set this up last week, my big problem with the Glaurung question, the Glaurung's early escape question, is that how do we do that without making him look dumb? I mean, he could be young and foolish, but if our first impression of Glaurung is that he's pretty dull-witted, then it's going to be hard to undo that impression later on and have him be the master schemer and manipulator that we want him to be later on. Glaurung as manipulator, you know, like Glaurung in the scenes, you know, not with Turin but with Nienor, is like the most terrifying dragon I know. Like that, I don't know anybody who did a more terrifying dragon in the history of literature than Tolkien with Glaurung and Nienor. Like that is absolutely terrifying. That moment when Nienor turns and there's Glaurung's head on the top of the hill staring at her in the eyes, right, is the creepiest dragon moment ever, as far as I'm concerned. And so why does this guy get out? There seem to me two options here. well, three options. One is just to make it a young, foolish mistake by him. But again, I have problems with that. Or I think it's going to create problems for us down the road if we do that. The other two options would be that his getting out is somebody else's plan and it's not his fault. And we make it clear that this is not his plan and that he's been snookered in some way. But again, even that kind of undermines him a bit. Or three, we change the circumstances some. And by changing the circumstances some, so in the text, when he gets out, it's not a huge deal. Like, he's contained and turned back and forced to flee back into Angband by Fingon and his horse archers, right? I'm not saying that the text says it's no big deal at all, but it's a relatively minor skirmish. That's the thing that I think conceptually causes me the most problem. If Glaurung gets out and everyone's like, and Fingon is like, it's okay, guys, I got this, right? Don't worry about it. We don't have to mobilize or anything. This isn't a big deal. I just gotta send, you know, this beast escaped and I gotta turn it back. If we make it a bigger deal, right? If we make Glaurung's escape and rampage at the end of season four, closer to a disaster, then, or, you know, a less limited disaster, right? I mean, if he accomplishes more, then I think I'd be a little bit more comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder also if there could be a super cool, an interesting way to present it where, we don't show like his daring escape,
right?
But rather, we present something that looks more like in an initial presentation, it just seems like a really like a bad forest fire or something.
Right.
And then only at the end do we reveal the Glaurung in the middle of it, and that he's the cause of it or something. So it seems like a disaster.
Right. Sorry, I'm laughing because Håkon was just trolling me by saying, "Do you mean he could kill a large number of elven wives?" Ha 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 ha. I agree. Like it should be some kind of large scale disaster, right? And as you say, maybe we don't fully understand it at first. Let's see. I like your idea for the visual representation of that, Dave.
It's less is more.
Yes. And, but
also the folks managing the CGI budget will be grateful.
Yeah, because we just need to bring in some like stock footage of forest fires, and we're good.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. get some stock 1980s Smokey the Bear footage, and we're all set.
Yep.
Only you can prevent rampaging dragons. which they'd have to put signs like that up around Angband afterwards, obviously.
Yep.
Yeah, and as Ellen points out, it does have to be plausible for the elves to remain overconfident without appearing as idiots as well, right? So we do have to manage that side of the affair, too. The other thing that I have to, that we have to remember, this is the final episode, right? I mean, this is the end of the season, right? So the escape of Glaurung has to look like a big enough deal to be like a foretaste of disaster to come, right? As we will be cheerfully ending season five with a Daggor Bragalax. So, this is a deliberate parallel that we're setting up here at the end of season four. Oh, cool. Ellen says that an actual visual effects person joined the forum this week. Cool. Neat.
Yes.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah. Okay, so We want a situation. So let's just spell out all the elements that we want to happen here. One, we want the elves to have a sense of foreboding and yet have good reason to think that they have things under control. Right? So that they're as Ellen says, they're overconfident without being stupid. Right? But yet there should be enough reason for at least some of the elves to be like, I have a bad feeling about this. Right? That's one element that we need. And also, and by the way, another element that we need is Fingon being heroic, right? And possibly more. There could be other people in addition to Fingon who are being heroic there. Secondly, we need Glaurung being cunning. I think we have to establish, if Glaurung is going to be the cunning master manipulator, we have to have him be at least, you know, showing base cunning and not foolishness, and not, he's not a dog let off his leash, you know, he's not one of Trish's horses escaped from the pen, you know, he's not, he's got a bigger plan than that, right?
This contradicts my appeal for minimalism on his escape, but I think it'd be funny if afterward there's signs up everywhere in Angband about how, like, for the orcs, warning the orcs, don't talk to the dragon.
Don't talk to the dragon. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But he's not going to be able to achieve. We have to make him not achieve whatever end he was going for, I think, but mm-hmm. without looking like a fool either. Glaurung looking like mm-hmm. a fool either. What is his end? He's been caged up for a long time, right? I mean, maybe he just wants to, like, kill stuff, right? He wants to burn some things. Like,
he's a sower of discord, you know? I mean, it's like Agravain in the Once in Future King series, right? He just wants to be bad. He just wants to sow discord everywhere, plus get gold and power.
Maybe he has an end which... So, his trip out is only a failure if his plan is to just, like, go on a rampage and destroy the whole continent, which he failed to do, right? But that doesn't have to be his plan. You know, maybe his plan might be thwarted. Well, what's his plan? Okay, what's his plan?
I'm wondering, do you think maybe sort of that he's been positioned, that Morgoth has been sort of priming him and talking to him, and sort of that Morgoth's clearly his goal is for him to be a weapon of war. But maybe somewhere along the line, one of the orcs who got caught in conversation with him mentions one of the elf kingdoms, and he decides that his goal is to go and capture one of them.
Right.
Or something in that vein, that he has a very specific desire or thing he wants.
One desire of his, which would be easy enough to understand and would certainly fit within the character that we see in him later on, and which would certainly fit within the overall milieu of the bad guys here, is that he's tired of being kept down by the man. Right. He wants to start his own thing. Like, he wants to be to run his own plots. He's not content to be like, all right, here I am, like the secret weapon. No, it's OK. Take a couple more centuries. I'll wait. I'll sit in this cave, as Hakon and Marie are all pointing out. You know, he's like infused with hatred and then kept in a box. Right. So, you know, like, that's not a happy situation for anybody. But it's not just that he is like an elemental force who wants to be released. Remember, he sets himself up as Dragon King in Nargothrond. Like, my thought is that that's his end goal. Like, when you ask Glaurung what his, like, five-year plan is, that's his five-year plan, right?
Right.
Yeah. I agree with that. I think that's what it is. And Morgoth doesn't, initially at least, doesn't really want him to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's not ready for that. So he and Morgoth have a sort of a difference of, I mean, Morgoth has like created him as you, he's artillery, right? He's the tank, right? Like, you know, he's designed to be the heavy in battle. And Glaurung is not content just to sit around and be a battering ram, right? He wants to set up on himself. I like Hawthorne's suggestion that he's tired of the orcs calling him Glomond. Or Glorund. That also bugs him too. Can't the orcs ever get his stupid name right? You know, Hawthorne, I have to admit, I'm like, I do sometimes toy with the idea of using some of Tolkien's, like, having a running joke of, like, Tolkien's earlier names for things, like other people calling it being like, that's not what it's called, right? Like, somebody calling the thing the Nauglafring and, like, somebody else giggling. But anyway, like that, no. Or close, but not quite. Let's call it something else. Anyway, he wants to set himself up. Morgoth wants to wait because he wants to reveal him as like the big shock and surprise in the great battle that he's planning, which of course is ultimately going to be the Dagor Bragalloch. Glaurung doesn't want to wait for the battle. He wants to set up for himself earlier. So that's what he's trying to do. So when he breaks out, what if he's being stealthy? What if instead of rampaging and then being turned away, like rampaging and then having a short-lived and sort of pathetic little rampage, you've got your fire thing, Dave, right? But then he's trying to slip out so that he can go find somewhere, establish a center of power, and begin to, you know, maybe find a nice cavern somewhere, ideally with some treasure already gathered in it, that he could find and settle down in and sort of set up shop for himself. And then he's found.
It's kind of interesting because it calls to mind the conversation between the two orcs in Return of the King.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Somewhere there, where there's a lot of loot, nice and handy, and no big bosses. Yeah.
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 In essence, that probably should be a common thread in all of the evil characters. That at the end of the day, they're not content to serve Morgoth.
Exactly.
Or Sauron, or whatever.
Exactly. And that's one of the consequences of like being evil. Like when you turn away from the worldview that's based on like humility and community and instead like set yourself up. That's what happens. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Caritas says this kind of also reminds me of Galadriel, which is uncomfortable. Yeah. It should be a little uncomfortable, Carita. That's exactly it. Yeah. Anyway. Okay. Yeah. So no, I like this. I like this a lot. He's fought and turned back valiantly, because he's discovered, right? The elves find him. Somebody was asking how he could sneak. Well, yeah, he's pretty big, but it's a big world, right? There are mountain ranges to hide behind and forests to creep within. And we know he can creep within forests even in his later days. Even though he's still big enough to knock over trees in his death pangs still, he could definitely, be trying to sneak out quietly, and he would be seen and reported. So we would then, this creates a nice little plot line, doesn't it? In like a nice little, episode 12 to 13 plot line where we have some of the vigilant elves who see him and are like, what on earth is that? And then he's, and then they go and they attack him. And then we get a whole sequence, right? Not just a battle, but they've got to track him down and then he's going to flee. That also helps to prevent him from being easily overcome. He's going to run away, Right, because once he's discovered and they come after him, he's like, okay, you know, I'm not really ready to fight the entire forces of the Noldor all by myself, so I'm gonna cut bait and return to Angband, and I, you know, I guess we'll try it Morgoth's way, and then I'll try to set up for myself. I'll push my 5-year plan back to a 10-year plan, and come back to this later on. But that, of course, also then gives us the ability for the Noldor to be like, dude, we chased him away. Did you see how scared that guy was? Right. He just turned tail and ran. Like, we can obviously handle that guy. Right. So with again, some people being like, I think he might be capable of a little more than he showed us there. So, yeah, you guys get. As we're working out the outline, and as you guys are working through the scripts and stuff, we can decide. We definitely want the surprise to be awesome when Glaurung appears. But actually, that would be kind of fun, wouldn't it? To have like tracks of him be seen, right? People come across like his slot in the grass and being like, "What is that?" Right. And then like we see the Glaurung reveal at the big fight and everything. Ellen, I am totally fine with him manipulating Gothmog. Gothmog is kind of my whipping boy of the bad guys. I'm ready to like lump every bad idea onto Gothmog here. So having him deceive Gothmog into letting him out. Such that he can blame Gothmog and Gothmog can take the fall for him. Again, if we want to show him being a manipulator in that way, I have no objection to that. I think that could work. And Mariel, yeah, he absolutely can do some damage. The fight is not going to go easily, I don't think. I don't think that we have him turn around and run right away. I think that he fights with him, but he's smart enough to see once he's discovered and they're onto him, there's no, you know, so he'll fight the ones that find him and put up a good fight. And maybe he'll even just destroy something nearby out of spite, right? But town baiting is fun, after all, for dragons, right? But I'm just saying he's going to retreat fairly quickly because he's too smart not to, right? He's too smart to think that he can just take on all comers, right? Indefinitely once he's been discovered. Mario, we could build it up that way too. A squad of elves could find him and get slaughtered completely, right? And their bodies could be found. And again, we don't know what killed them. This was no orc work here. You look at the big burned patches. What caused this? You know, is this a is there a Balrog out or whatever? Because remember, when a Balrog shows up, it's a big deal, right? And the elves will know this, so they'll be very nervous that, you know, a Balrog has invaded and what's he doing? Maybe. I mean, that's got to be their only theory, right? I think there are bunches of ways that we can set up the storyline and increase anticipation without spoiling the surprise of his appearance. Cool. Oh, hang on a second. I think I lost Dave briefly. Just like we lost me briefly earlier on.
No!
Hang on a second. And, all right. There we go. He's back now. Okay. All right. And there he is. Okay. There we go.
Dave's back.
Excellent. Okay. I think that seems to solve all the problems, or at least seems to tick all the boxes of what we really want to accomplish on both sides there. I think we have some good opportunities for elvish heroism on the part of both men and women, let me emphasize, and we can kill off as many men as we like, it's all good. Okay, so I think that I think we're good. Let's think about the elf women issue. Okay, so again, one major issue that people have been pointing out is that we've been killing off a lot of female minor characters, like the wives and daughters and sisters are all superfluous until it's time for them to get killed. Let me back up a second and say, and because I've talked about this before, I mean, you know, this is not the first time this has come up, you know, and we've mentioned this before when we've talked about this. The primary reason we keep finding ourselves in that hole is we want to be careful with our management of characters. I think we have to make or perhaps re-examine some decisions that we've made. One of the decisions that we've been operating under is that we don't want to make changes to the existing story that we don't have to. So, for instance, one way I keep talking about this is like characters who have a job in the story, right? Characters who do a thing in the published text that we need them for, right? One way, of course, and you all know that this is a way that Hollywood likes to do when they're doing adaptations of this kind, right? One thing to do is to take some of those jobs that are given to male characters in the published Silmarillion and give them to female characters instead. That would give us the freedom to kill off those published male characters. We've generally not done that. We have tried to avoid changing too much. When, again, unless we feel a need, there have been some times where we've added storylines where there weren't, where we've created distinctions, where distinctions aren't really clear, where we've developed stories that were either unmentioned completely or underdeveloped in the published Silmarillion. But rarely have we made that kind of decision to say, like, okay, instead of having Angrod be the guy who, you know, reveals the kinslaying to Thingol, let's, you know, have it be, you know, an unmentioned in the published text female character, and let's just kill off Angrod at the Helcaraxa, right? That's the kind of decision we have resisted making because we're wanting to be faithful to the text, because we want to build on the story that we have instead of just changing it. I was about to say arbitrarily, but of course that's not an arbitrary change, right? I mean, that's a change for a reason, right? Because the majority of the characters, even though there are awesome female characters in the Silmarillion, the majority of the total number of characters are male. Okay, so that's one thing that we could do. Now, I'm still not hugely happy about that. But the alternative is to basically take the female characters who are either non-characters in the Silmarillion, the published Silmarillion, I mean, or characters who are only very, very briefly alluded to, or even only implied, and make them into characters that have serious jobs in the narrative, equal to the jobs of the people in the published text. And the problem with, I mean, all, every option, let me emphasize, I think we have to be clear about the fact, every choice we make has potential difficulties that would have to be overcome, okay? There is no, like, easy solution to this problem at all, okay? There's no zero loss solution. If we promote a lot of minor or non-characters from, and again, here I'm just talking about the published Silmarillion. If we create/promote a bunch of characters, then we are expanding the dramatis personae, which is already very large. Now, I agree with suggestions. Somebody was making this, it was a long time ago and like 300 comments ago, so I don't remember who it was. Somebody was saying that it is, of course, possible to introduce like a random minor character briefly without having it be a distraction to the episode. Those the example cited was, you know, things like, you know, shows like Firefly or Babylon 5 did that really well. Have like a minor character who only is in like two or three episodes. and you know, and then they're gone, and then they're done, and that's fine, right? You don't need to like then keep. You don't have to like. They don't become this like endless pantheon of characters you've got to keep track of. I agree. Two things. One, the characters in neither of those series are immortal. And secondly, I have no objection to doing that. I have no objection to creating a character who is going to be. In fact, we've kind of done that already, right? Like what I was suggesting with Anael, or Anael, I find his name hard to say. The elf that we suggested for the unwitting spy, Tuor's future foster father. That would be an example, right? He would be in a couple episodes, right? He would be a significant character in a couple episodes, and then he'd go away, and we wouldn't see him for years. Right. And we'd have to be, you know, and when we do see him again, you know, when Tuor escapes into the wilderness and meets him, we will definitely have to find a way to do a, hey, remember me? I was in this show 7 years ago kind of moment. And that's fine. Right. I have no problems with that at all. So introducing minor characters in that way, I think, is absolutely fine. Yeah, Marie points out that Nurwin in season two was like that. Sure, absolutely. My problem is that these characters are going to be around, a lot of them, for a really long time, unless we kill them off, which nobody wants us to do. Again, I'm not objecting to introducing new characters. Again, we have lots of... I think that we, as the show execs, have shown ourselves willing to introduce new characters, right? As long as there's a need for them. And I think we've shown ourselves willing to introduce new characters that when we do introduce brand new characters, we're willing to you know, have them be women or even to gender switch them, right? Like giving Celeborn a sister, as we did, to be the... you know, the leader of the, you know, the, narco-syndicalist commune that is, the Green Elves in Osiriant. We've done that kind of thing. We gender switched Tel'kar. Exactly. So, you know, not at all resistant to this on principle. This is why, to me, the big question comes back to that first one. Again, we have been operating under the premise of A, we don't want to cut characters from the canonical story unless we must, right? And we've been reluctant to say that we must, okay? So if there's a job that could be filled by, you know, if there's like an extra role that can be given to a canonical, like remember when we were like going back to Anael again, when we were brainstorming, hey, okay, we need an elf who can be suborned as the, you know, who can be kind of corrupted, psychologically corrupted by Thur and Gwethil and Sauron and be the unwitting spy in the camp of the elves, or be the, anyway, the, like the face of the, of that class of elves in Sauron's plan. The first thing we did was say, who could we, like, of the elves that we have, the characters that are already available in Tolkien's corpus, published corpus, I would emphasize, in Tolkien's published corpus, of those elves, are there any elves that we could put into this role so that we can have fewer one-shot characters that we have to keep track of all over the place? That's been our thing. Now, Ellen, I want to address this directly right now. I'm not saying that the stuff in, like, the peoples of Middle Earth is not canonical. Tolkien wrote it, and it absolutely is. What I'm saying is, I've been teaching Tolkien for, you know, I've been doing this podcast for 10 years, and I can tell you that the majority of Tolkien fans, not of people, of Tolkien fans, have a hard time keeping track of the cast of characters in the published Silmarillion alone. Okay? I know. I have years of empirical evidence to say that, which informs me that even Tolkien fans have a hard time. And I know, Ellen, you are in the blessed minority when it comes to that. But most Tolkien fans have a hard time keeping track of the list of characters in the published Silmarillion, and it is the mass of names and trying to keep track of everything, which is where most of the people, most Tolkien fans, fail to read the Silmarillion through the first time. And the reason most of them fail is trying to keep track of all the names. This is what all of my... This is what all of my experience in the last decade has led me to. This is why I am really loath to just introduce Nick. And I know they're there. I know they're there. But in my mind, we're pushing the envelope even by keeping all the Silmarillion characters. Like, I thought Peter Jackson pushed the envelope by not trimming down the number of dwarves that went with Bilbo in the Hobbit films. I was ready for that. You know, we talked about that in Riddles in the Dark. We thought he might, right? And I thought it was gutsy, and bold of him to keep all 13 of them and try to distinguish them as he did. Again, I'm not... Goodness knows, I get really annoyed, too, with what I view as a tendency for film adaptations to dumb things down. And I'm not trying to dumb things down. But we do need to be careful. I mean, I do think that there's a limit. And I want to be really cautious with the number of characters that we introduce on top of... pretty much. I mean, how many characters have we cut a single character from? I don't mean killed off. I mean, cut a single character from the published Silmarillion. I'm not aware that we have. I can't remember a single character in the published Silmarillion that we decided we're going to cut. Right. And, you know, that's still our primary text. It's still all of the history of Middle-earth stuff, totally relevant. But, but it's totally relevant, but it's not our primary text, right? It's a resource that we can freely use, but it's not our primary text. All of this is actually not yet relevant to the stuff that's on this slide. I just wanted to address the core issue of the question of characters and introducing characters. Because, again, I'm not seeing it. Like, back to the question of killing off the women. Killing off women. Okay. There the problem is, we've got to kill somebody, right? People need to die. We can't just kill red shirts all the time. Right. If we kill red shirts all the time, we're not the thing is not going to have the kind of emotional impact that we need the story to have for it to be true to the Silmarillion. Right. The Silmarillion needs to be gut wrenchingly full of loss. That's like Tolkien, gut wrenchingly full of loss. That's almost the number one criteria of a faithful Tolkien adaptation, in my opinion. Right. So, and that's why I am so apparently bloodthirsty in these conversations and saying I want to make there be as much suffering as possible. Not because I just enjoy watching people suffer, but again, having people experiencing grief and loss like that, that's so central, I think, to not just the Silmarillion, but Tolkien's thought. If the loss is to be felt, the characters who die have to mean something. We have to have significant characters dying. Which leads us back to question number one. Are we willing to kill off, instead of killing off the characters? So if we have the two groups of characters, right? Characters who have roles and jobs in the published text and characters who don't have roles and jobs in the published text. If we decide what we've been doing is not killing off women. What we've been doing is killing off people more people in that second category than in the first, because we don't want to reallocate their jobs if we don't have to, right? So we're not going to kill off Angrod yet. We're not going to kill off Ignor yet until he gets killed off, right? We've got a job, a big job for Ignor, right? We haven't randomly killed off Feanorians. We did kill off one, but it wasn't random, right? So most of the time, and he didn't have a job, right? Angrod doesn't accomplish much, right? He doesn't have any real jobs. He's noted as being in a couple places, but give me a paragraph on what Angrod exactly accomplished himself personally in the published Silmarillion after the burning of the ships, right? I mean, he's barely mentioned. So he was, in that sense, as far as jobs in the text are concerned, comparatively expendable anyway. So that was fine. We have tended to be killing off characters in category two. And the fact is, based on the way Tolkien wrote the text, there are more women than men in category two of characters. So we've not been preferentially killing off women. We've been preferentially preserving the roles that are there in the text. And I think if we want to shift that, then we're going to have to, we're going to have to shift roles. We're going to have to do some gender switching. We're going to have to give some of the jobs that are given in the text to men to women instead, which I'm okay with. We can talk about that. So Ellen, I think you're exaggerating. We're treating female for two things that I feel very strongly about. First of all, by killing people off, remember, we're treating them as people by killing them off, right? We are trying to capture the real suffering, right, involved here, the real loss. That's important. I keep using the phrase red shirts, right? These are not just people that we're killing off on away missions in Star Trek. Not at all. Not in any way. The whole reason, whenever we have brought in somebody's wife or daughter or something in order to die, we've done that in order to maximize the human impact, not just on the man, but on everyone, right? On the other female relations of that person, too. Because women are people and are important, and so we care when they die. If we didn't, I wouldn't suggest it. So I object to the idea that if we kill off a female character, that means we're dehumanizing that character. I think that that's backwards completely. Secondly, there is no second thing. Never mind. I think that's fine. And I think that that is very different from fridging. And I would be happy to have a debate about that. And we did talk about this. We had exactly the fridging discussion earlier on. So I have no manner of objection to develop the stories of the women before they die at all. Not at all. I just, two things. First, I want to make sure that we're not having to go out of our way to create new jobs. Again, we've got lots of jobs being done by lots of characters. I don't want to create new ones in the storyline. Okay. What we're going to talk about here in a second, what's on this slide, these are societal roles, which are going to be in the background. I've never had any objection to things being, to nuanced elvish society being shown happening in the background. What I'm talking about are plot roles. Plot jobs. Scenes with dialogue and action, right, that involve these characters participating in the story and contributing directly to the story. That's what I mean by a job, okay? And if we're going to if we're going to create new plot lines, we've got a lot of plot lines here already, right? And again, we can choose to take some of the plot lines canonically given to male characters and give them to female characters instead. If we don't, I would like to know exactly. I just don't understand. How are we meant to develop their characters more, their personalities more? If we, I mean, where, how, like literally on scene, how are we going to do that? I'm not saying it's impossible to do that. I am open to ideas. I'm just worried that we've spent a long time now talking about all the different overarching plot lines that we want to fit into season four, and it's a lot. If we can do it, I'm all for it. I'm game. Pitch it. Let's hear it. But I don't want... General principle, our danger here as storytellers is shoving in too much, not leaving gaps. You know, I don't think that anyone is going to, you know, listen to the story that we're trying to tell here in the film project and be like, you know, there just wasn't much happening, right? I mean, it's too bad there weren't any characters and you know, like nobody ever did anything like this. It's going to be like hard to follow and keep track of everything is going to be the problem that we're bumping up against, I'm pretty sure. Okay. All right. Okay. So let's let me think about let's think through some of these societal roles that people were talking about. I do think I, you know, maybe I shouldn't have started with what I started with there. I ultimately feel that the objection to the killing off of female characters is an oversimplification. I really do. I think you're oversimplifying the stories that we've been trying to tell. I get it. I really do get it. If we were dehumanizing female characters, that would be a problem. I do not think that we are. And I don't think that having them die is dehumanizing them. As I said, I strongly object to that. I think it's an oversimplification. And I think that, and Ellen, I think you in particular seem to think that I'm being resistant to way more than I'm being resistant to. I'm not at all resistant to any of this stuff or to anything that we can do and still be telling a sensible story that's going to be able to be powerful and understandable by people, I'm perfectly willing to do. I think it's a great idea. I think that y'all keep killing off women is an oversimplification. That's all. Okay. So, And Karina, see, this is the other thing. I don't want to, all right, it's fine. No, I'm going to keep talking about it. It's just, I'm going to refer to it here. Karina, exactly as you say, so Karina says, as long as we're not primarily using female characters as this sad backstory for the male characters. No, of course. But guess what? Like, often people do have, like, there are going to be a bunch of widows and widowers in the Silmarillion, right? And it's not bad to have, like, it is not fridging, by definition, to have a character die in order to have it have an effect on another character. Like, that's not, like, that is such an oversimplification. It is often what happens in a story, right? That the death of one character affects other people. And often, we don't have time necessarily to make every single character before they die. You know those things that George R. R. Martin does, where he, like, does a 50-page diversion giving us the entire family history of the minor character that he's going to kill off in an inconsequential way at the end of it, right? In order to accomplish a tiny, piddling plot point, but we get the entire backstory of the character before that character's almost completely inconsequential death, right? Now, you can do that. If you're George R.R. Martin and you're writing an infinitely long fantasy series that may never get finished, you can do that kind of thing. I'm saying I don't think we're going to have time to do that kind of thing. So, Tony, exactly. What happens in real life is that, like, people's death affects other people. And we can't apologize for that. You know, Turgon in the story is motivated by the death of his wife. And why shouldn't he be, for crying out loud? Why should we, why should anyone be upset if we show the death of Turgon's wife in order to show the effect that it has on Turgon? Because Turgon's an important character. And yes, in the big picture, in our story, he's a bigger character than his wife was. That's okay. We can do that, right? And we can do that without being accused of fridging. And no, we don't give all of the men personalities before they die and none of the women. But again, back to the fact that the majority of the characters given jobs in the primary text are men, right? So unless we want to change the roles, that's weird, that, you know, that's the bind that we're stuck in here. So anyhow, I don't want to overreact to what I feel is an overreaction, but I think we need to be careful here. I think we need to be careful, and I'm not going to go 10 miles out of my way to avoid, being accused of fridging, when I think it's a superficial reading, when I think it's a superficial accusation. People can make the superficial accusation as far as I'm concerned. And Bree, exactly. Everybody dies on Turgon. Everybody dies on Elrond. Like, we're going to kill off a bunch of people and show the effect it has on Elrond, right? That's what happens, right? Let's talk about these roles. So this was a really cool discussion that happened on the board. And this was what I was talking about at the beginning when I said that they had a really cool digression, which is exactly how we so often do this in the broadcast as well. When you start thinking about a particular issue or a particular plot line, which then leads you into thinking about larger questions, right? You know, sort of doing more, you know, sort of fleshing out in world building, what are some elements, and thinking about what Tolkien said about this and thinking about how we want to adapt that in the story. So we've got this this concept of a dichotomy between hewers and fighters in Elvish society, and this trend that the majority of women are non-fighters and the majority of men are fighters, but that there is in fact more crossover than you tend to see among mortals. And the role in particular here is the role of Bisan. I've never been quite sure how to pronounce that. The one who grows the wheat and makes the lembas and gives it to people. Melian, right, as the lembas giver, right, of Doriath. She is, of course, the classic model for that. And the model which, of course, Galadriel is enacting, right, later on in Lothlorien. This role, this person, is always female. There aren't any examples of men in this regard. Though I would point out, when Elrond and his giving of Miravor, it's not the same, but it's a similar kind of role that Elrond plays. There are certainly parallels between them, is what I would say. I'm not saying it's the same role, but there are parallels between the role that Elrond plays, especially in his giving of Miravor, and the Lembas Giver role there. Marie said that the discussion is suggesting that somewhere between 5% and 30% of women would fight, and similar percentages of men would be non-fighters. Yeah, and I would lean even, I'd be totally fine leaning more. Maybe 25% is where I'd be perfectly content visually, right? You know, if about a quarter of the Elvish army is female, and about a quarter of the, you know, of the non-fighters are male, that, you know, that would kind of work for me. So this other role, Herald, the second in command to a military commander, being possible to be filled by a healer. Of course, the classic example of this, in fact, really the primary example of this that we have, is Elrond, as the Herald of Gil-galad. So that's a role which, again, is sort of on the, I kind of like the idea of that being filled by a non-fighter, of course, not only because Elrond and Gil-galad would appear to fall into that pattern. And so we can sort of show that but I like the idea, of having that happen, because it sort of shows, I think one of the important things that we would want to resist, there's always the temptation. I mean, goodness knows there are lots of patterns of society, right? Where you have the warrior class and the non-warrior class, and the warrior class is usually dominant, right? Because they're the ones who will beat your head in if you oppose them. Whereas the people who are the non-fighters are less likely to do so. So in a lot of societies, the warrior class is on top, and the people who are healers are lesser, right? And lower in the social hierarchy. I do think it's super important for us to show that there is no lesser in hierarchy there, that the Elvish people as a whole obviously value the healers and the Beskyn as much as they do, at least as much as they do the fighters, that I wouldn't think there would be any sense of hierarchy between them. I think that they would see these all as important roles that they're playing. And then scholars, of course, there are surprisingly few examples of scholars, actually, in Tolkien's stories. Rumil, of course, also comes to mind as a scholar, in addition to Pengoad of Gondolin. And I guess one thing I would say here, I'm not sure that I would differentiate there. I'm not sure that scholar and healer is necessarily a different group. So when we use the word scholar, I think, and when we think about scholar as a category, it seems to me that we tend to think about that, the image that word tends to conjure is the idea of somebody who sort of retreats from active roles in society in order to study things, right? I mean, that's like the modern academic concept, right? And that doesn't seem very Elvish exactly. I don't think that an Elvish scholar would be retreating from the world and studying abstractly, right? I would think that, nor am I even sure that it's exactly a subset of the non-fighting healing people. I think it would be a little bit more fluid than that. That is, I would think that those who seek to gain a deeper wisdom and a more intimate understanding of how, you know, the world works, right? That's what I would think a scholar, like if there's a thing called a scholar, but that's what healers would be too, right? I think it's the same thing, right? So I would think so Marie, I agree that someone who studies and teaches would be a non-fighter. Absolutely. I'm just saying I wouldn't distinguish them from healers. Like, I would think that all healers would be scholars. Like, I think it would be interesting to show that as being the same thing. Certainly, I don't think that there would be any distinction between, like, book learning and practical action. Because I'm not even sure how many books elves have, frankly. And we've talked about that a little bit too. The whole written word thing is not of instant and immediate use if you are an elf necessarily. Not that writing isn't of any use, but again, libraries. How many libraries are there in the elvish world back at this point? You know, when elves start to die out and stuff starts to get destroyed and memories threaten to be lost, then, you know, maybe, yeah, you know, then I could see in the first age and in the second and third age, some elves being more dedicated to building libraries and preserving lore. But much, much less so, I think, at this stage. Yeah, exactly, Ellen. I mean, their brains are such that they don't have much need for that. So, Marie Rivendell is a library, but again, it's a third age thing, right? I mean, when we see the Library of Rivendell that we see is the third age library, right? So anyway, I think it would be interesting just for us to have a greater blend of that, of those concepts, healer and scholar. I mean, and artist, frankly, same thing, right? Same thing. I don't see any major distinction there. So I would blend all of those categories into one thing, into the larger category of like those who are focused on, you know, understanding, interacting with and enriching Arda, right? Like that's like the definition of non-fighter in Elvish terms is, right? Is to do those things. And so the real fluid lines. So like Pengalad, Maglor, Dairon, Elrond, all of the healer figures, like all of those would be understood to be in the same. It's not that they all do exactly the same thing, right? Just as you have, you know, you might have, you know, like the different Noldor who have different interests, right? And different kinds of crafts and things like that. You would have obviously non-fighters who would have lots of different, of course, craftsmen, another example of a non-fighter, right? Curufin and Celebrimbor, with their forge work, right, are also non-fighters who are also artists like Maglor and Luthien and Dairon, right, though not in the same media and not focused on the same thing, and like Pengalad and like Elrond and others, right? So I really see all of those things put together and really flowing together. But I also, I think we need to be careful again. And I'm not suggesting that the division between elves, like the different classes of elves are like human societies. My point is that they shouldn't be, and we need to be careful to make sure that they're not taken that way. So just as we want to make sure that we're not suggesting that the fighting class of elves is the superior or dominant class in elvish society, so too I think we need to make sure that we're showing that the fighting elves aren't dumb, or, you know, that they're not thugs. There has to be a lot of fluidity there. I mean, every elf, even a fighting elf who's dedicated to, you know, somebody like Mablung, right? Mablung of the Heavy Hand is, to me, like, when I think of a fighting elf, Mablung is one of the first ones that comes to mind for me, right? Maedhros especially post Angband Maedhros would be a pretty close second, but anyway, like, even them, right? They do a lot besides fight. They live a long time, right? If you're alive even for 1,000 years, you've got a lot of downtime. Right? You can spend a lot of time training. You can be prepared for battle, but the amount of time that you spend with a weapon in your hand is still going to be the vast minority of your very large stretches of time in your life. And you're still an elf. You're still going to be a craftsman. You're still going to be an artist. You're still going to be a healer. You're still going to be doing, you know, lots of that kinds of things. So we can certainly show some that are way, I think we can show some that are totally non-warriors, You know, some which just have totally dedicated themselves to the non-fighting stuff, and so they really don't take up arms at all. And their only contribution in a conflict, as we showed with the spiders, right, back in season three, is through artistry, like Dairon and Luthien, I'm referring to, of course, back there in season three, is through artistry and not through arms, right, through swords and spears and bows. But at the same time, the fighters can't be one-dimensional, right? That can't be. They're going to be zero elves. Even Mablung is going to do something, right? Even he's going to play an instrument or something, right? I think that we really need to show that. Yeah, definitely. So, absolutely. Yeah, and Ellen, my implication in all of this, of course, as we said at the beginning, is that men and women. So yes, men and women are all, you know, in both of these categories, and I think that we show that. And I think it's one of the things that it would be fun to go back and think through as we are going through, of course, our next stage. Right, the next thing we're going to get to is mapping out the outline, of the episodes, right? Taking all of the stuff that we've been talking about and really mapping out how we want it to proceed. As we do that, it will be interesting to be thinking through our cast a little bit more clearly and giving them roles. Again, I want to be careful about pigeonholing them too much, because again, I think that all of them are going to be most of them anyway, are going to be fairly nuanced. But still, I definitely think, Tony, Gurney Halleck, right? Absolutely, yeah, from Dune, the great swordmaster who's known for his skill at the Balisad and his songwriting. Absolutely, yeah. You've got to think, if Gurney Halleck can do it, then you know, even like, you know, Mablung of the Heavy Hand can do it, right? So that's great. That's great. Okay, so some more examples. Thinking about, I think it would be fun to think through, to do some of this, to apply some of the. I've said this before. This is one of the really cool things of being able to do the film stuff, is that some of the things we get to do are some of the things that Tolkien always wanted to do but never got around to. That is, taking some of the ideas that he had later on, whether they be ideas from The Lord of the Rings or ideas from his later post-Lord of the Rings work, and doing the work that he never lived to do, which is work it backwards into the Silmarillion story, right? So yeah, by all means, let's think through some more things about these societies and fit the characters, some of the characters that we do have, into some of these roles and into these the pictures that we're able to develop of these societies. Though I would want to add, we can't forget that we want to have some clear differences between Noldor societies and Sindar societies as well, right? So we need to make sure we're not making the society's too homogeneous here in thinking these through. But yeah, Arathel would be the Baesan of Gondolin. Yeah, that makes sense. She would be the Lembas giver there. I like Idril is certainly the brains of the operation. One way or another, there's no question about that, right? That Tolkien is very clear about. It is Idril who's like, maybe we should make a way of escape, right? Let's think about a secret tunnel that might be prudent, right? That was Idril's idea. You know, we know that Idril is definitely the brains there. Having Curufin's wife be a healer? Yeah, sure. Mythros will need a healer when he's rescued. again, my question is that a, are we going to have a, I mean, we can introduce her. We can, I mean, are we going to have a scene where we can really make a well-rounded character out of her? Are we going to have enough time to be able to make a well-rounded character out of Kurofin's wife healing Mithros? Maybe, maybe. You know, we can, that's possible, but I, you know, again, my worry is always trying to squeeze in too much, not leaving out stuff. Just because something needs to happen doesn't mean we're necessarily going to have time to show it on screen, is the main thing I'm concerned about there. But yeah, absolutely. I love the idea of Orodreth being a healer as well. So instead of showing Orodreth as just, you know, wussy, right? Instead of just showing him as being weak, he's just not a fighter, right? And this would place him naturally. So showing the role that Orodreth falls into with Turin, right? When Turin comes to Gondolin, listen to me. I'm sleep deprived again. When Turin comes to Nargothrond and becomes the dominant lead, you know, fighter leader there in Gondolin, Orodreth, though he's the king, right, kind of slips into the second in command role, right? And I think it would be kind of cool to set that up as a pattern in a way that we can, you know, make that make sense. So it doesn't look weird. It doesn't look like we're, you know, it doesn't make Orodreth look bad. It's a natural place for him to be. And it makes what happens with Turin and what Turin does in Nargothrond a little bit more on Turin, which is, I think, no harm done, and B, a little more tragic. The High Kingship is a military position. We had decided that, right? When we did our digression on what does kingship mean among the elves and what exactly is the job description of the High King, we had decided that the primary job of the High King was to be military leader of the combined forces of the Noldor, right? That's an implied subtitle of the role of High King. So that does mean that High King would have to go to a fighting elf then, not a non-combatant elf, which also gives us all kinds of convenient ways to explain the reason that Turgon becomes the High King after Fingon, right? Yeah. See, so Ellen is concerned, which is very sensible. And Ellen is very sensibly concerned that Orodreth being a healer and not a warrior makes it hard for him to be king, because kingship in wartime would also be a military position locally as well. Yeah, but what if that's a mistake from the... We just make that a red flag from day one, right? What if the elevation or choice of Orodreth as king in Nargothrond is a reflection of the attitude of the elves of Nargothrond. What if it's a bad sign, right? And Ellen, exactly, that does also give a non-sexist reason for why Idril isn't the next High King of the Noldor after Turgon dies, right? But again, Turgon was not the son of Fingon either, so there is no absolute reason to believe that it necessarily has to pass down father to son either, right? Ellen, you're right about Orodreth and Minas Tirith, though. Are we doing Minas Tirith? Is Minas Tirith happening in season 4? I'm forgetting. We haven't talked about it that much. We've mentioned it, but we haven't talked about it.
I don't think so.
I don't think we've talked about it. It needs to be built in season 4. Could we do it in season 5?
I say kick the can.
Hoping to procrastinate? No. Yeah.
Kick the can.
I agree it needs to exist during the siege, and obviously it has to be there before Sauron takes it over. But that doesn't mean it can't be a season 5 thing. Season 5 is still... Siege lasts 2 seasons. Nick says, hey, maybe we should just split season 4 into 2 seasons. Ha, ha,
yes.
Ha. Well, we'll have to think about that, where that goes. We'll have to just include that in our list of stuff to work through in the outlines and see where we can do it. I'm a little nervous about it, honestly. I'm not saying it doesn't make sense, and I know that in the text that's where it is. I'm just like, do we have a story for it? Is it... Yeah, see, David, I'm kind of inclining towards that, too. I kind of think after the battles, hey, I've got a plan. What if, yes, Glaurung escapes through the gap, right? When Glaurung gets out, when he sneaks out, he escapes through the gap of Sirion, which is where he's going to go later on. Also, so it prefigures his later moves. He gets all the way down to the gap of Sirion. And they see, like, okay, this is, we've got to be super careful here, right? So after the Glaurung thing at the beginning of season 5, they're like, let's build a new fortress here, to like help to keep an eye out here, right? And we can and so that starts that, and then so we have them build it at the beginning of season 5, and then Sauron can take it over before the end of season 5 so that he can be running it later on.
I
know, Marie, that Finrod and Turgon building things is a story in this season, but that's exactly my, like, they're already busy building Nargothrond and Gondolin, and I'm not sure I want to distract from that. I think I want to keep the focus on Nargothrond and Gondolin, because Minas Tirith is minor. It's important, but it's minor. Way more minor than I don't want to create any sense of, like, and they're building 3 things, Minas Tirith and Nargothrond and Gondolin. Because keep in mind, everyone's going to think Minas Tirith is more important than it is anyway, because they recognize the name, right? As soon as we call it Minas Tirith, everyone's going to be like, ooh, they're building Minas Tirith. And they're not going to know that it's not actually all that important, right? So if we have them building 3 things, one of which is Minas Tirith, there's going to be a bunch of people who think that Minas Tirith is the most important one of the 3, right? So anyway, that's why I'm just suggesting. If you guys hate the idea and want to work it in, I'm open. But I really want to I really want to bring in the focus there. We'll see. Well, but Ellen, we do need to focus on it more than we do Himring or Barad Ithil, because it is going to be more important than they are later on. Like, action's going to take place there. It's going to be a major centerpiece of action in the Beren and Lúthien story when it's taken over by Sauron, right? We do need to, it's not as important as Gondolin or Nargothrond, but it's important to establish for storylines, so that it's, because having Finrod, having the cleansing of the Isle and Finrod buried there, right? Tolan Garahoth is important. It will play an important role anyway in that story. So I do want to give it a little bit of a spotlight, much more than like the other perimeter defenses that they set up. Because it, unlike they, it is going to be a significant theater of action in a very important future story. So, anyway, we'll see. We'll see. Exactly. Finrod dying in his own tower matters too. Exactly. So, not to mention, here's another possible angle. Finrod is setting up in Nargothrond, right? after he's set up in Nargothrond, and I know this is changing the book sequence, but bear with me. He sets himself up in Nargothrond, but we want to show that Finrod, although he sets up in Nargothrond, is not an isolationist, right? Turgon is going to go isolationist in Gondolin. Finrod is secret, but not isolationist. He's going to be interacting. And so his choice to be like, hey, let's build a frontier fortress. I'm going to build Minas Tirith. This is part of Finrod's statement of being like, Nargothrond is hidden, but you know what? We're still here, right? And we're still going to help with the siege, even though we're hiding, right? And so it's a major statement about Fingon's character and about his goals, right, that he established in Minas Tirith. And so therefore it links it with him clearly, so it makes it significant when he dies there. And then after his death, that's when Nargothrond goes full isolationist and they choose their healer king, because they're out of the military biz, right? They're just in full hiding mode, and so they choose a healer king or a Dreth, right? Kind of works together, right? Just suggesting. Fingolfin will need people to talk to. So having Irame's daughter around, sure. There are a bunch of characters who are... Okay. I'm going to make a hierarchy of characters here. Hierarchy of characters. At the bottom, we have extras, right? People whose names we don't know, who are just like random elves killed in the kinslaying in order to be corpses, right? Because we need a bunch of corpses strewn around if we're going to have a kinslaying, right? Elves in order to like swell armies because it's going to look stupid to have only a handful of elves marching. We need a bunch of elves, so we're going to have a bunch of extras, right? So those who are like completely non-characters, and they can still have an impact, right? Like, how, like the gender balance of those, for instance, is one of the things that's going to have an impact on the impression that the whole thing makes. So it's not that those characters are insignificant, but those are in general unimportant. Individually, they're all unimportant characters. And again, my objection is that their death doesn't convey much loss, right? Okay, so we've got the extras class. Above the extras class, we have the class of minor characters who don't have major jobs and don't appear in very many episodes, right? They can still have personalities. They can still do things. They can still be people, right? It's fine. Again, we have to be careful about how much screen time we can afford to give all of them, because there's dozens and dozens of people like that. But they're people, right? And we can make people of them. And the majority of the people that we've killed off, be they male or female, are in that category. Because those are the kinds of characters to kill off. The class above them, which are the major characters who have important jobs and are dominant figures in the story, play dominant roles in the plot, it's harder to kill those off without making big, big changes to the story, right, to Tolkien's story. There's the character in between the bottom two. There's a third layer, right? So you got the major characters, you got the minor characters, you got the extras. In between minors and extras, there's this other class of characters, I don't know what to call them. And those are characters that are on screen a lot, but we don't really know them, right? Like the people who are often with our primary characters, whom we may never meet, whose names may never get mentioned, who may never even have a line or more than one or two lines, right? Yeah, repeat background faces, Ellen, exactly.
Repeat background faces.
So, right. So having Fingolfin, if Fingolfin's herald were female, right, member of his family or not, right, if she, that would be fine. No problem with whenever we see Fingolfin in battle or we see Fingolfin, in his war councils or something, there is always, this woman who is with him, and she doesn't have to. We do, you know, do we have a name for her? Is she gonna? Are we gonna develop her backstory? Are we gonna? Is she gonna get a lot of lines? We might not have a lot of lines for her, right? Kierden sailors, Marie. Yeah, there are gonna be Kierden the shipwright. We were talking about people, so you know, we're kind of we have a couple people sort of hovering between the minor character line and the repeat background faces level, right? People like Galdor, who is going to get lines in the Council of Elrond, but might not do very much of significance prior to that, right? David, that's an interesting example. David points to the character of Gothmog, the Orc General, in the Return of the King film. We don't really know anything about him, but he's a very recognizable face. I think actually he's big enough to be, I would call him a minor character, even though we don't know his backstory. He's not a very well-rounded, humanized minor character, but he's in it enough. I would say he's more than a repeat background face. Heck, like the other eight Nazgul are kind of repeat background faces in Peter Jackson's films. I mean, they needn't be in ours, as we talked about last time. You also missed that, Dave. We totally talked about potential backstories for the Nazgul last week. We were totally working that out. Exactly, Ellen. Not visible background faces, but repeated background, invisible background
repeat
faces.
Invisible That's background.
It's a totally legitimate subcategory of that class.
Repeat invisible presence.
Repeated invisible face. Right. He's got a nose. It's an invisible nose.
How did you end up on the Nazgul in the middle of the First Age?
Oh yeah, we went to because we were talking about the result of the human cultures and the corruption. We were talking about the fall of man, and then where that happens, and the cultural consequences of that, and then how some of the descendants of some of the people are going to be Nazgul eventually. So that's
our digressions on the Silmarillion film project are always meaningful.
Always meaningful, and they're going to pay off in spades. Maybe not for 10 or 15 years, but they're going to pay off. When we get back around to that.
Yeah, but we remember that we had this conversation.
Absolutely. Okay, cool. So there's a lot of things that we can do in some of those. I think so some of these things, some of these different societal roles, some of these different people, they may not appear on screen. And again, I think this is another thing I want to come back to. I think that some of you, and Ellen, I think in particular, were feeling like I was being resistant to like ascribing any of these roles or developing any of these roles or ideas, you know, for women or for the female characters that we kill off. Not at all. My point is just, I don't know that we're going to have screen time or enough lines for everybody to give everybody a full story. And it's so some of the women that we kill off might be repeat background faces. None of them are going to be extras. If they were extras, they wouldn't do the job that I want them to do in the story, right? We wouldn't weep for them. I want us to weep for them. That's a big deal, weeping for them, right? They need to at least be repeat background faces. And if not, they can be minor characters. And what's more, there's absolutely not only is there no reason that we shouldn't, there's every reason that we should ourselves work out the background. Like, by all means, let's think through what roles all of these people have and where they are so that we can figure out where to place them and how to introduce them, whether it be as a repeat background face or as a minor character. But anyway, yeah, absolutely. I have absolutely no objection to giving them roles so long as there are enough roles to go around. I think that it's easy at this stage to be like, let's make
cram
them all
major
characters. Yeah. Let's include everybody. Let's give everybody a well-rounded story. We don't have as that many minutes. And I think that's a good thing. I think we need to abide by that restriction because it's healthy and fun, I think. If it works, awesome. I am 100% for it, and I think it's a huge enrichment of the story. I absolutely love doing it. In fact, part of what I object to so strenuously is the idea that I'm resistant to that. I'm not resistant to that. I'm just trying to be the voice of caution and prudence, because I'm all about caution, prudence, and sticking to limits. That's like my thing all the time. So, right, Trish? I mean, come on, is that not my middle name?
Oh, limits is your middle name, that's right, for sure. Right.
Limits, discipline, and absolutely, you know, prudence. That's it. That's it. I mean, if there's one thing I'm not known for, it's biting off more than I can chew.
Anybody or, in the Exploring Lord of the Rings class could tell you that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. yeah. Yeah. so, okay. Now, let's not forget about Luthien. Suggestion from Eliza on the discussion boards. Maybe she could be present at a gathering where two characters or factions start arguing. It gets heated. She starts singing to calm them down. I can imagine her being subtle about it, like she's just doing a performance for entertainment's sake, but she puts enough calming vibes in it that makes a noticeable difference. Eliza, I think it's a cool idea. I'd like to expand that, actually. The Marathatter thought, right? So the Marathatter thought, which is, just to remind everybody, that's the gathering when everyone is, it's like the feast of, like, mostly reconciliation, right? When everybody mostly is, like, at least trying to pretend that everybody's friends now. There is a huge chance, there's a huge chance that that could go very badly, right? I mean, the difference between, hey, everything's forgiven and we're all friends now, and kinslaying part deux, right? Like, it's not a huge, like, it could go either way. Like, it would be super easy for things to get out of hand, especially, you know, when you invite Caranthir. So, I think that, what would be really good is for us to have, there should be tension, a good deal of tension at the Marathatter thought. There are going to be some people who are not down with the reconciliation idea on either side. Some who are distrustful of the Noldor, some Sindar who are distrustful of the Noldor, some Noldor who look down on the Sindar, right? Not going to mention any names. Having Luthien play a role there, basically where, like, there's a moment where it looks like things might go sideways at the Marathatter thought, right? And Luthien intervenes and sings and dances and peace is established and everything is okay. I like that. I think that would be a very public role so that everybody sees her. Everybody knows who she is. And now I know, Ellen, that she didn't go to the Marathatter thought in the published Silmarillion. I know she doesn't, but I think it's, I'm not insisting on it. I'm just suggesting it as an idea because I think it's one way to introduce Luthien to everybody. And it's true that here's the other thing. I don't want to make Thingol. I want to be careful with Thingol. We don't want to make Thingol from the very beginning one of those fathers in medieval romances who puts his daughter up in the top of a tower, right? In order to ensure that some courtly lover is going to come and woo her down the road, which is what always happens in medieval romances when fathers lock their daughters in towers. You might as well put up a neon sign if you do that, apparently, in medieval romances. But I don't want to push Thingol into that role. I don't want his fall to be that quickly. I don't want to be that sketchy that quickly. Yeah, he's going to be protective of her. Yes, he's going to want, I mean, he's not going to be comfortable with men. And so Baron coming is going to be a really big deal. But we can make his protection of her against Baron a step forward for him, both a change in the circumstances, right? Because again, we're talking about this like skanky human guy instead of just like elves of uncertain provenance, and also a step down in him from the earlier days, right? Because we're talking about two seasons from now, right? When that happens. So that's why I would want to be careful about making Thingol too much of an overprotective dad from day one. So I would rather have him let her go in that way. Yeah, and no, I get it. You know, Ellen, I can definitely see the impulse to kind of laugh at Thingol. I get that. You know, you seem to feel about Thingol in some of the ways like I feel about Celeborn. I get that. I get that. And I'm not above bringing some mockery into Thingol's later actions. But I just don't want to make him static. I don't want to make him a joke from the beginning in that sense.
He seems to be a tale of somebody kind of running afoul of a fatal flaw later on, right?
Right.
In an extreme situation, right, where he's got possession of a Silmaril and that kind of stuff. But like early Thingol, I was thinking about this, you know, a superficial read, he does look kind of like a classic kind of overbearing father.
Right.
He does lock her
right.
in.
But, right. That's certainly his role
so,
in the Baron and Luthien story. Definitely.
Yeah. But like his broader role in the Silmarillion, like he's a pretty cool guy.
Yeah.
And he gets a lot right.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. For a while. For a long time. For a long time. Yeah, definitely. I agree. I do think that he's... And the problem is he is the king of all of the Sindar. So if we lower him, we're already going to be, again, fighting against that higher-class elves, lower-class elves thing. We don't want the Sindar to look like the peasantry of the elves and the Noldor to look like aristocrats. Already, visually, they're going to, because the Noldor are going to be swanky and polished and pimped out much more so than the Sindar. So there's already going to be a temptation to see the Noldor as upper-class in a crude human sense. And we want to be careful about that. Though they are, the Caliquendi, Moriquendi difference is a real one, and I'm not trying to deny that at all. But again, we want to be careful about that. And if we make their leader too, I don't know, low, I guess, right? If we make him kind of a joke from the beginning or weak from the beginning, it places all of the Sindar in a potentially compromised sort of position. I know Karina, he's going to escalate to the locking into the tower. That's totally going to happen. I'm not opposed to it. I just want him to start there. That's all. I just want him to start there. Now, Ellen, I wouldn't object to that. I wouldn't object to his initial impulse being worried about having Luthien go and have Melian talk him into it. So we see some like reluctance, but it's reluctance that's overcome, right? So we can see like the shadow of overprotectiveness to come. I wouldn't have any objection to that. I just wouldn't want him to be like, no, like go to your room, Luthien, you know, from the very beginning.
Right. That should be the locking in the tower should be a step in a direction as opposed to a part of a consistent pattern.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like we shouldn't be shocked by it. We should foreshadow it. We shouldn't be shocked that he does it
we can show the
impact. but we should be disappointed that he's gone that far.
Yeah. 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 Agreed. Now here's the thing that I also like about the Merith Adarthat idea. Sauron and Thorin Gwethil are there, Ellen, as you were just pointing out. Mike, Amy's Revenge, there at the bottom, says, I'd like to invent a Sauron scheme in Beleriand to cause trouble and have Luthien overturn it while he's away. It's too soon for them to directly meet. There we go, right? Remember, the Merith Adarthad is going to be one of the centerpieces or sort of starting points. Well, again, sequencing is what we're doing later. It's going to be one of the important moments in the Sauron catch and release program, right? So Sauron and Thorin Gwethil's insidious gaining of information and subverting the elves and the relationship between the Noldor and the Sindar, that's going to be a feature one way and another at the Merith Adarthad, right? So what if plan A, right? Sauron's plan A is to be like, he's like, hey, how about we go for broke, Thuringwethil? Right? Let's try to turn the Marath Adarthot into a bloodbath. Wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't that be awesome if we get Kinslaying Part 2 right here and now? Right? I mean, come on. That would be a coup, wouldn't it? So what if that's plan A? So what if we show them in disguised form, right, sort of manipulating, arranging meetings between, you know, like they're like mingling and comparing notes and being like, oh, we've got to get Carinthir and Angrod together. Right. Absolutely. Let's give them a few more drinks and then put them in conversation and see what happens. Right. So we can show them kind of manipulating things and working so that she is. And they're, and it's not just social manipulation. Their power is at work here, too, in influencing and even, well, let's stick with influencing the wills of the elves involved. Right. And then Luthien undoes it. Right. She doesn't undone everything. She doesn't undo everything they do, but she stymies that one particular maneuver. Right. Which, of course, is one of the things that's going to lead them back to go to plan B, which is rather than foment an immediate another kinslaying, we'll instead go back to the spying and opening the back door for the at the Dagor Aglareb plan. But that way we can set up the we can foreshadow the Luthien Sauron conflict, or at least show Sauron. I mean, wouldn't it be fun? Come on, wouldn't it be fun? And not just fun, but useful, right? To have Sauron being like, oh man, that Luthien chick is trouble, right? Like, I'm gonna, like, you know, I'll get back at her if it's the last thing I ever do, right? I mean, wouldn't it be kind of fun to have a little bit of an element of that so that when Luthien shows up, right, at Tol Ngarahoth, Sauron is like, oh no, you didn't, right? Like, that is it. I am throwing down with this girl right now, right? Which leads him to his rash decision to take on Wolf Sauron form and go, you know, to try to attack her. You know, I think this could work. I think we can combine those two things very well there. And I think this also fits the while Luthien shouldn't be insignificant, we don't want to give away her later exploits by involving her in adventures too directly, you know, too early. Agreed. We don't want to have her roaming around. We don't want to have her like uncover and thwart a major continental plot. But again, if she happens to be there and, you know, is instrumental in thwarting a plot, she doesn't even have to know that it's a plot of Sauron. Exactly. Right. She just sees the trouble brewing and takes steps to circumvent it, right? So, I think that can work. And so, can we please send Carinthir to the Marath Adarthad? Please, we need troublemakers. We need tension and troublemakers at the Marath Adarthad. We totally do. Like, that has to happen. I'd really like Carinthir to be there grumpily. Why not? Why can't we have Carinthir there? Is there a good reason for him not to come? I mean, it's true that it makes an even stronger statement for him to be like, no, I refuse to attend. But, Marie suggests that Mithros told Carinthir to stay home and he shows up anyway. Right. Right, yeah, exactly. He's the super embarrassing brother who shows up drunk at the Marath Adarthad. I like it. I don't know. Anyway, we can work that out when we look at the plottings, and maybe I know you guys have said that I'm beating up on Carinthir too much, and I don't want to make him, you know, my stooge all the time, you know.
Thingle, we want to maintain his dignity. Karanthir
has no dignity. Yeah, exactly. So I want to be careful. When we look at the big picture, I don't want to go to the Karanthir well too many times. So, again, I'm trying to be open-minded about that. I'm just saying there need to be troublemakers. And he suggests himself, as he always does to me when I want, a guy with a bad attitude. Anyway, okay, all right. We can work that out. Last important question: Luthien's relationship with Galadriel. That's a really cool question, and a really subtle question, because we get almost no direct connections. The only direct connection we get between Galadriel and Luthien, I mean, direct, like, indication of like some kind of interaction, not like they were both in Doriath and so they must have known each other. The most direct connection between Galadriel and Luthien is that Galadriel's granddaughter is the spitting image of Luthien, right? They have to have known each other, and this is it's too big to ignore. We can't, both of them are far too important characters to be living in the same place for a long time without our giving any indication of their, their interactions. Besides, think of all the Bechdel test possibilities we're missing out on if we don't have conversations between Luthien and Galadriel. Okay, Ellen says, the suggestion was that Galadriel recognizes Luthien has power and tells her she could be a great ruler. Right, so Galadriel and Luthien would be very different in that way. Galadriel, we know, has this kind of yearning for power, right? And Luthien would not. I agree. I think that Luthien should absolutely not be there at all. So showing a contrast there. So using Luthien, therefore, as a contrast to emphasize the potential sketchiness of Galadriel. Sure. Yeah. Galadriel, of course, would point to Luthien's mom, right? And be like, your mom's a good ruler, right? Your dad's ruling, obviously. Everybody knows your dad's really in charge and stuff. But, your mom is doing her thing and she's doing her thing well. And that seems like a good thing to emulate, right? And, anyway, I'm saying Galadriel obviously can make an argument, and clearly we don't make Galadriel look too bad.
You think Galadriel would have mom envy? Gee, I wish she was my mom.
I wish she was.
You're so lucky.
You're so lucky that you're descended from a goddess like that. Yeah, as Ms. Marie reminds us, Galadriel's mom just died, so that's going to be a little hard.
Karina.
Karina wants them to have a hair conversation. Yeah. That's good. Luthien's, yeah, when they're like, what do you do with your hair clippings, right? And Luthien's like, I prefer cloaks, and Galadriel's like, I'm thinking ropes, actually. But I don't think that's a conversation we need, but Nick,
put them on display in a nice little ornate container.
Display pieces, yes. I prefer my hair clippings to be displayed for all posterity. That's really the ultimate purpose there.
This is after Fëanor's asked her.
Yeah, exactly.
Her, right?
Exactly, right. Yeah.
Hey,
would it be too much for like Curufin to be really interested in Luthien's hair? Right? Like the hair of shadow.
Oh, there you go.
I could do so much with this. Holy cow, right? And he could be like, hey, Luthien, that was a great dance and everything. Thanks for what you did there. Could I, would it be weird if I, yeah. you know, it's a motif then. Maybe if we do it often enough, it will be less creepy each time, you think? Maybe, probably not. But anyway.
And then Gimli's request becomes like, well, he would ask for it.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Then it's a thing.
It's a thing. It's a thing then at that point, yeah. Yeah, okay, so anyway. But Nick's made a super important point in the middle of that, that Galadriel would, it would be very natural for Galadriel to be taking Melian as a, like a surrogate mother in after the death of her own mother, right?
Yeah, and that's so, kind of what that was the spirit of what I was kind of talking about.
Exactly,
actually.
And with so one way to go, then I mean it would be easy. It feels to me psychologically easy, at least on Galadriel's side, to have there be like a sort of pseudo sibling rivalry between Luthien and Galadriel, right? I mean, like how many alpha females can you have in one forest, right? Especially with the, like, your mom is kind of my mom, but she's really your mom, and now she's my surrogate mom, and now you're kind of my surrogate sister, and now we're sisters, right? So anyway, it's...
I could totally see Galadriel doing that.
Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Not so much that Luthien would necessarily buy into that, but Galadriel certainly will, given her wanting to rule a realm. And, you know, she just kind of has that attitude where she would set herself up kind of in competition with Luthien. I could see that.
Yeah, I mean, there could be maybe a little bit of an edge on that with, but see, the thing is that Luthien has to be the kind of character that, like, you can't really keep, like, nobody can hold a grudge against Luthien. Like, if you can hold a grudge against Luthien, like, that's pretty much the litmus test that you're a horrible person, right? Like, Luthien has to be the kind of person that, like, nobody can hate. Right, because
yes.
She's totally.
Karina came up with their celebrity name, Gluthien.
Gluthien.
Yeah, yeah, and Ellen, you're right.
No, that's true, and I think that's probably that could be part of Galadriel's growth. Actually, is maybe she? It's like what you know. What's that Zen thing about you don't resist? It's just you know, like Galadriel's the one like getting herself all worked up, and Luthien's not, and Galadriel kind of grows in the experience. I don't know. I mean,
no,
that's a lot.
Because, I mean, one of the things, and this is a thing that I've been talking about for a while, proud people, there's, if someone has, you can tell if somebody has a problem with, like, this is a self-diagnosis you can do, right? Do arrogant people really get your goat? Do you really hate somebody being arrogant and prideful and drawing attention to themselves? If so, you are almost certainly a proud and arrogant person. Like, that's how it works. That is true. Pretty much 100% of the time. You know who is not bothered and who is sometimes just sort of amused or pitying of arrogant, stuck-up, proud people? Humble people, right? Again, almost 100% of the time. So pride is one of Galadriel's problems, right? She has a core pride issue. She wants her own power. She wants to establish dominion. She does care what other people think about her and about her own status. Luthien doesn't. Luthien is completely humble, so there is no mutual rivalry between them. But I think Galadriel's going to feel twitches, right? She's going to feel it to some extent. And so I do think if there's a way that we can show that, Trish, exactly what you're suggesting, her kind of having some kind of issues, her, you know, because Luthien... I mean, Luthien is greater than she is. Luthien is better than Galadriel. Luthien is a more powerful singer. She's more beautiful. She's like, she is higher than Galadriel is, but she's more humble than Galadriel is. Okay. Luthien does, and because again, really humble people are super hard to hate. And so yeah, so I think working that dynamic in and that can be part of the thing that we work into both the initial story with her and Celeborn and the whole her working through her issues and his being her confidant story that we were building there. We can kind of work in maybe some sort of Luthien issues, some envy issues, as, because it's also part of her processing her grief for her mother, which is also one of the things that Celeborn is helping her process too. So yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Celeborn is trustworthy. Did I misspeak just now? Did I say the wrong name? Celeborn is being Galadriel's confidant. Did I say that wrong? I didn't say that wrong, did I? Just want to make sure. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Okay, good. Oh yeah, that's interesting. Ellen points out that Galadriel is basically failing to learn what Melian is trying to teach her. She learns good things about being a good leader, but she doesn't learn humility, which is one of the other things that Melian is trying to teach her. Because Melian is humble. Melian doesn't draw attention to herself. Melian, she's all that, but she does not go out of her way to draw attention to her how she's all that. She doesn't. She never tries to establish a realm of her own, right? She and Thingol set up shop, and he's the king of the Sindar, right? Absolutely. Okay, cool. Cool. That seems to work. Excellent. Hey, we did it! We stayed a little bit later because my Grifflet stream is canceled, but that's okay. So, hey, look, Marie, for the first time in how many weeks we've gotten to the questions for next time slide! So first of all, the next session is going to be delayed by a little bit because 2 weeks from today is the 22nd of March, which is the day before Sunshine Moot, and I will already be in Florida on that day. So I won't be able to do Silm Film on the 22nd. So we're going to push it forward to Friday the 29th, if that's okay. And then we'll come back the week after that on the 5th of April, and then we'll be back to our two-week schedule, which should be able to... actually, which from then will cunningly weave its way between moots and other travel of mine for a while, until May, actually. Okay. So what we're going to do next time is we're going to make an episode outline. Now, we're not going to outline everything. Like, we're going to do that in multiple sessions moving forward. What we want to be able to have is a general outline for how the sequence is going to run. Okay, so that we know what stuff to talk about in each episode. It is the overall shape. So we're going to be starting. We're going to be starting to think of the. We're going to be starting to think about the individual storylines and how they all fit together. But we're not going to work out all those details yet. There will likely be changes that we're going to make. What we're going to do is we're going to think this through enough so that in the episode after, we can begin working through episode by episode and refining the more detailed outlines as we go. Okay.
Sounds great.
Excellent. Cool. Cool.
That should that'll probably only take us 2 months.
No problem. No problem. Well, the original plan, which I think we can stick to after, because we think of all the digressions we've already accomplished, think of all of the issues that we've already handled, which normally distract us as we're going through episode by episode, right?
True.
So having already worked through all that, the work that we have left to do is much less than it usually is when we start our episode by episode thing. So this is why our aspiration was to do 2 episodes per session once we get there, because it's just hammering out the details of how all these things fit together. And not even all of the details. I mean, there's going to be a bunch of work still left for the script outline team to do as they actually try to make it into workable scenes and dialogue and that kind of thing that will flow from one thing to another. Just trying to make sure to hammer out the sequence and make sure that we're essentially emerging from the process that we've just finished with a really long list, both of particular scenes, particular things that need to happen, particular stuff we want to get at, and see occur. Our next our very next stage is to do a crude outline, right, you know, a general shape for the season now, having established all those things, episodes 1 through 13. A step after that is to then cross, like, check off everything on that list, right? Make sure that we figure out ways to include all of those things within which episodes as we build and have the story make sense as we move through episode 1 through 13. And then then the next stage, of course, will be the script outline team, who can refine that more and really develop those stories a little bit more fully and work things out. So, all right, that's the plan. And we'll see. And yeah, Ellen, it is sure possible that we won't get through the episode outline next time. Who knows?
Never.
Yeah, and cool. Oh, yeah, so... oh, yeah. Druid's Fire has reminded me of a possible conflict on the 29th, which I had forgotten about. So stay tuned. You will be informed about the next meeting.
Wait a second.
Yeah.
It's 2 weeks. It's the 22nd.
I know. And that's what I definitely have a conflict with. I am 100% certain that there's a conflict on the 22nd. I am now wondering whether there might be a conflict on the 29th as well. But let's stick with the 29th for now.
I have a high likelihood of a conflict on the 29th as well.
Yeah. Well, maybe there's a chance
we'll figure it out.
To shift it forward to the 15th instead, to do it next week instead of doing it 3 weeks from now. But we'll figure that out sooner rather than later and let you guys know. And I will, if you're registered for the webinar, I will post that and they'll send an email to you guys with the update on that. And if you are watching us on Twitch, stay tuned, and we'll try to have it posted where you can access it there too. So anyway, we'll be back. We'll be ready for next time. It looks like people are in GoToWebinar not hearing me anymore. But anyway, I will continue to say...
But we can still see him.
You can still see me? All right, here we are.
Hey, there he is!
Man.
You went away again.
I got issues with my ISP. But anyway, okay. So, thank you very much for your extended patience today with our session. And we'll keep you guys posted about the time for next time. Thanks, everybody, and I look forward to seeing you at our next session, whensoever that might fall. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.